This episode of the Rick Emerson Show is made possible by our good friends at Squires Electric, a brand new business partner. Squires Electric is a full-service electrical contractor for all of your residential and commercial needs. You can contact them at 503-252-1609, or for more information, go to squireselectric.com.
I remember everything!
I remember every little thing as if it happened only yesterday. I was barely 17, and I once killed a boy with a Fender guitar. I don't remember if it was a Telecaster or a Stratocaster, but I do remember that it had a heart of chrome and a voice like a horny angel. I don't remember if it was a Telecaster or a Stratocaster, but I do remember that it wasn't at all easy. It required the perfect combination of the right power cords and the precise angle from which to strike. The blood of the guitar was Chuck Berry red. The guitar bled for about a week afterward, but it rung out beautifully, and I was able to play notes that I had never even heard before. So I took my guitar and I smashed it against the wall. I smashed it against the floor. I smashed it against the body of a varsity cheerleader. Smashed it against the hood of a car. Smashed it against the 1981 Harley Davidson. The Harley howled in pain. The guitar howled in heat. And I ran up the stairs to my parents' bedroom. Mommy and Daddy were sleeping in the moonlight. Slowly I opened the door, creeping in the shadows right up to the foot of their bed. I raised the guitar high above my head, and just as I was about to bring the guitar crashing down upon the center of the bed, my father woke up screaming, "Stop! Wait a minute! Stop it, boy! What do you think you're doing? That's no way to treat an expensive musical instrument!" And I said, "God damn it, Daddy! You know I love you, but you got a hell of a lot to learn about rock and roll!"
It is 29 minutes after the hour of 1, and this, the month of December in the year of our Lord, 2010. Thank you for coming along and making a part of your listening day. We are live from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the milk packing district in glorious southeast Portland, Oregon. Thank you for joining us. It is Tuesday, and welcome to day 12. It is the Rick Emerson Cavalcade of Whimsy. Thank you for coming by. It's 503-505-6964, if you would like to be part of today's program, 503-505-6964. As the great on-turning of the phone happens right.
Is it?
Now. There we go. Excellent. It's 503-505-6964. If you would like to engage with us telephonically, with your comments, questions, clarifications, observations, ruminations, ponderings, musings of an ironic nature, whatever it is you might have. It's 503-505-6964. You can also email if you like. It's Rick at rickemerson.com. That is Rick at rickemerson.com. Dawn Taylor can be reached. That is Dawn at rickemerson.com. D-A-W-N at rickemerson.com. Text box is open. You can also message us via Skype if you like. That is Rick Emerson Show and so forth. Coming up today, we got your Hick Watch /... Let me make sure that I've got this. So it's a tasering inside a trailer park.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. It's like the turducken of news stories. Is there some...
only there was a clown involved.
See, if only there was a clown or if there was somebody beating somebody else in the face with a King James. So that is coming up. We got your top five today. This is actually... It's sort of a quasi-request. So somebody had sent me an email. Let's see, what was his name? His name is Ken. Ken sent me an email. Sorry, it's the cheapest joke. But it's just like sitting there. Here's the thing. Hey, you know what? You know what I never put together until just now?
What?
Do you ever receive communications from listener Ken Texley?
Yes.
You know Ken. He's a guy that he's at Court and Bobby stuff a lot.
Yeah, and he's a pirate guy. He's one of the pirate guys.
Here's the thing I can also say about this, because, you know, I say it with love. The first time that I think I ever met him, that we ever had sort of speaks, was at a Roger Klein. He's a huge Roger Klein fan. And so Laura and I met him at a Roger Klein show. And I think I've met him before that, but I don't think I'd ever had, like, prolonged conversation with him. But he's a person of size. He's a man of larger carriage. And he was just wearing a shirt that just said, I beat bulimia. And it was like, and at that moment, I just really, you know, there's something about a guy that just embraces it, you know? He just grabs it, and he is that thing. He just grabs it, he runs with it. He has a little self-actualization, as our friend Maslow would say. In any event, but, you know, he signs his emails. I don't know if you've gotten an email from him where he has his signature, but his SIG file... it's not even really a SIG file in the sense that it's like a quote from a movie or something. It's just his name, but it's obviously an auto signature. And his emails are all signed K-K-K-Ken in the K-K-K-Koov. And I actually just now, this very moment, put together that is a Fish Called Wanda thing. I guess I just thought he was being zany. I thought it was just sort of like he was just having a little panache. He was just trying to have a little style. Mm. All right. Well done, sir. Even funnier than I thought. All right. Well, in any event...
So you were saying something about someone named Ken.
Okay, but not that guy.
Right.
But there's a different guy who I was whimsically referring to as K-K-K-Ken.
Yes.
Anyway, but he was listening to the show the other day. And in the transition period between Legion of News and this show, we do, you know, we do a sort of a musical interlude in the live stream just so people don't, you know, this is not dead air or whatever. And so a guy heard me playing Surrender by Cheap Trick. And I've gone on and on and on, you know, over the years, many, many times about how, you know, in my opinion, that Surrender is... I'm just saying, for me, in the opinion of I, your humble narrator, Surrender is the most finely crafted, it's the most perfectly composed rock/pop song, like in the history of all creation. And so the guy sent me an email, and he said, well, out of curiosity, he said, what else? Did you arrive at that by some sort of, like, actual scientific, like, some sort of Socratic method of deduction? He said, or is it just a thing... a conclusion you arrive to without really sort of weighing it against other songs. He said, like, what else would be on the list, and do they all kind of sound like Surrender? And so anyway, so I have actually, to answer his question, and also because we needed a top five for today, and I thought, you know, two birds, one stone, or one rock, you might say. And so I've put together this list of the top five perfectly crafted pop songs that are not Surrender. So, in other words, answering the guy's question of what else would be on the list. If I had to create a list of the most perfectly crafted pop/rock songs, what would they be, excluding Surrender? So we'll do that later on today. So we'll do the top five. You have got a pop culture authority for the good people of Portland, Dawn.
I do. I'm really not sure what the question is, but it is an examination of the cultural icon, the Green Machine.
Excellent. So this is because we were talking about this with Anna Griffin on Friday.
Yes.
We were talking about Christmas gifts that you coveted, toys you wanted, but maybe you didn't receive.
Yes.
And so there was the big wheel, there was the Green Machine, there was the tricycle. But of the three of them, the Green Machine was really the peak of that trinity.
Yes. And we were curious as to where it had come from, how those levers actually worked with the steering, what was the deal with the Green Machine, and I have dug in, and I have found the information that you require about the Green Machine.
Fantastic. Here's the thing, is we talked about this, I guess, last week. We'd had some discussion about this, and I said, well, you ought to do that as a pop culture authority. And then you had said that it was actually really difficult to dig up information about it, that it proved very, it proved vexing.
Well, sometimes these things, the thing with looking at things from our past, sometimes it's kind of hard, because the thing is, I looked it up online. I didn't know who had manufactured it back in the day. I know that there is a Green Machine right now that is made by Huffy. And so I kept trying to dig into the past of the Huffy Green Machine. Huffy's been making bicycles for a really, really long time. and I couldn't find any information about it. And it wasn't until, like, finally just sort of by, like, just a happenstance of Googling something differently, I managed to determine that back in the 70s, when it was first brought out, it was manufactured by Marks. And once I realized it was, at that time, the Marks Green Machine, I was able to research it much more efficiently and find out more.
I just like the phrase, a happenstance of Googling. It sounds it just sounds like it would be some sort of
it's
a
like
weird...
like a murder of crows.
Use that, or just... it almost sounds like some quasi-Austen novel or something. So we've got that. So we'll do the Pop Culture Authority. What is the deal with the Green Machine? We'll just call it that.
Okay.
So that's going to be coming up here in just a while. Later on, the top five. Also, we got your Hick Watch coming up today. Dawn Taylor tracking the following headlines as well on this Tuesday.
Two people are arrested in separate false 911 cases. A grandfather drives in circles for 3 days because he gets lost at the airport. And an autistic boy is ruled okay for a sex change.
Now, when you the thing about the grandfather driving in circles, now, we had this yesterday, did we not? So do we have more on the story?
Well, I didn't actually tell the story, did I? We're going to mention it at the end of the show. I didn't get a chance to actually read the story, so I just sort of teased it. I said, got this story, I'll read it tomorrow.
I guess maybe we sort of riffed on it a little bit without actually hearing the story.
Right.
So, because Ryan White was here, and I think I made the observation about, you know, well, I got to take a little nap. All right. Okay.
So, yes, we didn't actually read it. And it's interesting, so I wanted to share it with the people.
Fantastic. All right, so I got two little things here at the beginning, and then we'll get to some other stuff, and we'll plunge on ahead. Again, the phones are open today at 503-505-6964. You can also email it's rick@rickemerson.com or dawn@rickemerson.com. Here's a little idea that I have. I'm just going to throw this out because there's no, really, I have no application for this. But I'm saying, so I was shredding some things last night at my house, and let me just say this about that. There are a few things that I find more satisfying than getting my shred on. Just sit there, you know. So for Christmas last year, Laura got me a new shredder, and here's the thing about it: it's not just a shredder. I mean, it is, but it's the kind that can do paper clips and it can do staples, also credit cards, and it doesn't do CDs. So that's going to be the next upgrade that I get. The kind that you like if you want to destroy a DVD or something. But I got to tell you, I don't like shred things. I don't shred things as they come in the mail or as they arrive. I put them all in a box. And then when the box either reaches maximum, you know, holding capacity, when it starts to overflow, or when I'm feeling, like a little bit of agita, I'm feeling stressed out in some way, or I'm feeling sullen and besmirched by life, then that is when I just pull the shredder out, and then I pull out the bucket of papers, and I just sit there, and one by one, I just feed them into the shredding machine, and it just renders them into so much papyrus mulch.
That sounds very satisfying.
It really is. Do you have a shredder?
No,
How do you live without a shredder, woman?
Anything that is sensitive that I don't want to go out into the dumpster, I burn in the fireplace. Which also is kind of satisfying, because I do the same thing. I save it all up in a box.
During the summer, too?
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
and then
fair
enough. Then I'll just sit there and light a fire and then just start throwing things in there piece by piece and watching them flame up.
You know, it seems like they ought to sell one of those things. Like, you ought to have one of those, those White House burn barrels.
Yeah.
You know, like Toby Ziegler has in his office, so he can burn drafts of the inaugural address or something, like if they don't quite work out correctly. So I was just sitting there shredding away last night. It was just fantastic. You know what I find particularly glee in shredding? Not just, like, sometimes I'll shred junk mail just to amuse myself, but usually I just throw that away. Like, I don't have a, like, I am not like Laura's crazy aunt, who actually, I don't know, we were, at one point, made an observation about some junk mail we'd received, and it wasn't even, like, it was just, like, from Shucks Auto Parts or something. It was, like, a flyer for, like, half off a battery. And her aunt said, and it's one of those things that sounds logical unless you think about it for more than half a second, where, Laura said, well, I got this junk mail from Shucks Auto Parts. And her aunt said, you better shred that. It's got your address on it. And it's like that seems like it makes some sort of a sense unless you really think about it. But I've
gotten really paranoid about the credit card things where you get the things where it's like, just send this back and you can get a credit card. And then I go to throw it away. And then as I'm about to throw it in the trash, I just go, but someone could fish this out of the trash and get a credit card in my name. You know, like, but it would still have to get mailed to my house. I don't know. But then I just go, screw it, and I put it in the burn pile.
I just destroy all that stuff, and I find special glee in destroying offers from credit card companies. When credit cards get, it's like I actually set those aside and I do those last. I do everything else, and then I take the credit cards that they send me unsolicited in the mail one by one, and I just, and the thing is, that, and they'll try, the thing is, and they, the credit cards, You want to talk about a business, you know, that I wish I'd gotten in on way back in, you know, like 1945 or whatever, when Diners Club first came into existence. We talk a lot about casinos and whores and booze and how, you know, like you got to start your own, like, Confederated States of Micronesia, you know, or whatever, some country from scratch just so you can get in the vice industry. If you can't get in it, like if you can't own a casino or a brothel, and you can't be running like a distillery or something, credit cards are the next best thing. Because I got to tell you, that is a scam like nobody has ever perpetrated on the people. And the fact that they now have, and I won't name the company because I think they probably all do it, first of all. But I got some credit card in the mail the other day, and my credit is actually pretty decent, way better than it used to be. I mean, my credit used to suck, but my credit has actually gotten better the last few years. But it's not like great, like I don't have sterling perfect credit. But a prominent credit card company actually sent me something the other day, and I swear to God, it was just one of those like jet black credit cards. As though I am ever going to be mistaken for like Paul McCartney, you know, like putting an like putting like an island or something on my you know, my credit account, because you're supposed to take it out and go like, oh, I must have the best credit in the history of the world, you know. And they sent me the little notification that they'd like upped my credit, you know, my credit score by, you know, my credit line by some amount of money, which again I am supposed to take as a compliment. The idea that they now believe I am fool enough to rack up even more credit card debt that I could not possibly pay off. So I set those things aside, and then at the end, I just run them through. But you know what I was thinking about? Because there's businesses that come to your, they'll come to your office, those huge mobile shredding trucks out front, like Iron Mountain, and they'll just take all of your crap out of the office, and they'll just destroy it in a truck out in the street. Somebody needs to use the following phrase, because it's not currently in use. You can have this, whoever wants to use it. Da-da-da-da, shredding company. Better shred than red.
Oh.
Bam.
That is good.
Bam. There you go, right there. It's at 32 cents.
I was visiting, when I was visiting Patrick at the hospital one day, I was walking along like one of those skyway things with the giant windows and looking down into the parking lot, and backed up to some secret door in the downstairs of the hospital was this huge truck, like the size of a semi. And it said, like, it was shredding, document destruction, medical records.
Yeah.
And sorry, and it was, but the truck was so huge that, you know, they must have, like, 20 different kinds of machines in there.
Totally.
To destroy all different kinds of things. And I wanted so badly to just get a tour. I wanted to go down and just go, can I just walk through your truck and watch you destroy things?
Just look at the industrial elimination machine that they've got inside. Because, the days of the shredder just, like, cutting things into strips are long gone, because they're have been, I mean, shades of like Batman Returns, but there have been like actual cases of guys just, you know, where they'll just hire some team of, you know, like I would imagine underfed immigrants to sit in a warehouse and just tape things together.
Yeah.
And where documents have been reconstructed. So now then they started the crosscut shredder, and now they have a thing. There's
well, they probably pulp it.
Their business actually will shred it and then burn it. They'll shred it and then they will not incinerate, but it's a word like it's like, but they'll basically obliterate it. Like they'll turn it into powder. There's actually, have you seen this?
Disintegrate?
Have you seen the, but it's a specific kind of disintegration where it literally, it powderize isn't a word, but it basically does that. I mean, it just renders it down into like the smallest possible components you can get without burning it.
It pulverizes it.
It effectively. I mean, I don't really know. I don't think you can pulverize paper as such, because I think pulverizing is punching, but have you seen that machine? They show this on the Discovery Channel every now and again. I think Mike Rowe went to look at this on an episode of Dirty Jobs. Have you seen that thing? I swear to God, it shreds cars.
No.
Oh, my God. There's a huge shredder. I mean, it would have to be huge, I guess. But it shreds cars.
Oh, my God.
I mean, and I don't mean like you take the car apart and then like you put in the headlights and you put in the tires and you put in the door. I mean, you put in the car and it just goes, and then out of the other end just come like metal shards. It's fantastic. It's so beyond fantastic, I don't even have a superlative big enough for it. It's freaking awesome is what it is. It's like that, it's sort of like, it's, I know there was that guy who I think has sort of faded away a little bit, but when, during that time a couple years ago when we were all watching the Will It Blend guy on the internet, I loved the Will It Blend guy. They should do a Will It Shred on the internet, but they have now a shredder that you just literally, it's like a huge clamp comes up. And it just feeds the car in like it was a giant piece of paper. And out the other end just comes little tiny bits of, you know, of Chrysler. It's freaking great. If you ever get a chance to go online and look at it, I strongly recommend
that
you do so.
I will look that up.
Better shred than red. I have then one question, one comment, and we'll get to the news here.
Okay.
One question. Do you ever get calls to your iPhone that it's like you'll miss the call, or it's like you just don't hear it or whatever, and you look down and you've missed a call, and the number is 000?
No.
Okay, I've been getting those like every day for the past 2 or 3 weeks, and they don't leave any voicemail. And if I hit reply, nothing happens. Like if I hit like callback or something, it's just that I'll look down at it and say, like, you have one missed call. And then I look at the call log and it just says phone number 000, and that's it. There's just no further explanation given.
Do you know somebody who died recently? Maybe they're calling from beyond the grave.
Maybe it's my grandmother. She's calling to ask Billy Mumy to drown himself up back. No, I don't. No, I have no. I have no explanation for it. And again, they're not leaving any message. And it doesn't. If I press it, it doesn't go anywhere. It just says, like, you know, cannot call or whatever.
I used to get calls like that on my phone before, and they were generally my old phone. And I'm trying to remember what they were. They weren't necessarily messages from the phone company, but. I don't remember.
Yeah, so yeah, I have no explanation. It's just that. And the other thing is, okay, somebody else is saying, he says, I have gotten calls from beyond. They are area code 000, number 000000. So it's, you know, 10 zeros in a row. And he says, what the hell is that crap? And the answer is, I don't know, sir. It can't be found out. Anyway, somebody will clue us in. But so if you've gotten that, I want to know, like, what the hell that is all about.
Yeah.
Finally. And this is one of those things that I would normally throw out to the people as a sort of like looking for a solution, looking for the answer. Except I suspect that the answer is just going to be that I got to open the phone book or whatever and call an exterminator. But I found out last night, I suspect, although I cannot say definitively. So I think I've got rats in my house.
Rats?
Rats.
Not mice, actual rats?
Well, see, here's the question. Because I've had mice. I've lived in a place where I had mice, and I don't think I've ever had rats to the best of my knowledge. But then again, so you usually don't see most of the rats in the world because they're usually hiding, you know, like underground, or they're in a cellar or something, or they come out at night or whatever. But, you know, if you've seen my house, and people... Laura and I talked about this when we first moved in, but Sarah takes great pleasure in telling me that I live in a duplex, which I do not, by the way, demonstrably.
It looks like a duplex.
I know it looks like a duplex. It's not a duplex. It's two houses that were freestanding, and what the guy did is because one guy bought both houses. They are both owned by the same property owner. And so the two houses are next to each other, and what he did is he basically just kind of put a roof over the top of the space, and now the space between the two houses is now this like weird ad hoc storage area. So he basically has just
so the two houses are connected to each other.
They are not, but they don't share an adjoining wall, which is the definition of a duplex. A duplex is two homes that share a wall. These homes do not share a wall, so let's have no illusions about that. Trust me, I've been over this like in every conceivable way. The point is, though, between the two houses is this storage area. And the storage area is where, you know, both, you know, we and our neighbors, that's where you start, like, it's like we put, like, we don't like a tool shed or anything, so that's where we put, like, our gardening crap, you know, or, like the dipstick thing that we, like, measure our heating oil with, and that's where we keep our dog food. And so last night, and the thing is, the dog food is almost always kept in this big Rubbermaid tub. That is when I fill the dog food containers in the house. When Lara does it, she does not always seal the Rubbermaid container. So I get up last night, like 3:30 in the morning or something. I'm just wandering into the kitchen to get, I don't know, get a glass of water or whatever. And I hear this, like, rustling around in the hallway outside of our kitchen door. Because it's like you get into there from the back door from our kitchen. And I hear this rustling, and the first thing I think is, all right, well, is it the neighbor? Not the neighbor. Because I look out and I don't see anybody. You can see the whole thing. Not a homeless guy. And then I stand there for a while. Then the rustling starts again. Then I move. I go to open the handle. And as soon as I touch the handle of the door, then the rustling stops. And, you know, back and forth. It happens 2 or 3 times where I'll stop. The rustling will start. Then I'll move. And then it stops. And then I hear what sounds very much like a squeaking. But then at that point, I thought I was just sort of hallucinating the whole thing. Like, I couldn't be sure. So I thought, well, maybe I'm just hearing noises now. Like, I want to hear those. So then this morning, I go out and I open up the door and I walk into the back hall and I pick up the door, and there's just these huge ass holes. Chewed?
Chewed.
Doesn't chewed seem like it ought to be a word?
Yeah, but it's not.
Well, whatever. These huge holes that have been chewed in the bag of the dog food, and they look way bigger than they ought to be for mice. I mean, I don't know how big like a hole chewed by mice is going to be, but this is substantial. I mean, it is like the circumference. It's like a coffee cup around.
That's big enough for mice.
Really?
Well, yeah, if they had plenty of time to work at it, but because they'll chew at something. But I mean, it could be rats. Depending on how big the, you don't have a big enough, big enough opening for like a raccoon to get in there, do
you? See, that was the other thing, is I thought it was raccoons, except there's a door that leads to the outside, and the door was locked and shut. However, it's a wooden door, and it's worn away a little bit. So at the bottom, there is this place where there's a little sort of half moon where the door doesn't meet the floor all the way. So something like a rat or a mouse could certainly get in. Yeah. I don't think it's a cat. I don't think a raccoon could get in.
Okay. Then, yeah, you probably have a rat.
Probably. I mean, how would I know if it's... Well, first of all, is one worse than the other? Rat seems like it would be worse because they're bigger. But then but do we really get rats here?
Yes.
Like, do we have rats in Portland?
Yes. Yes, okay. We do. The thing is, well, rats are everywhere. That's the thing, is that you don't really see them most of the time because, like you said, they hide like with mice. If you are actually seeing one, or you see that, you know, they've gotten into something,
right,
then there's more.
Okay.
It's not just one rat. They don't live like by themselves like loners.
They're not solitary creatures.
You know, but they do. Rats do live outdoors and they will get in. They will. But yeah, keeping your dog food out there in anything they can get into is basically just an invitation for rats to come into your garage.
Yeah, and it does seem like, and here's the other thing. The thing that is weird about it, though, is that the dog food is in, it's like in the huge 50-pound bag or whatever from the vet.
Mm-hmm.
So the dog food is in this bag, but the bag is sitting in a huge Rubbermaid tub.
You can still smell it.
Okay, but here's the thing. The Rubbermaid tub is in the middle of a concrete floor.
Mm-hmm.
So my thing is, how are they getting into it? Because the Rubbermaid tub is still like 2 feet high.
Well, it's... If the lid is... I mean, they can climb up almost anything. They can climb up metal pipes. They can climb up the sides of walls.
But you can't climb up a sheer plastic wall.
A
spider could do that, but there's no... I know there's superhuman.
Rats can also jump.
See, so that's the thing. So maybe that's what makes you think it's a rat, because it's like... I mean,
Rats also have, like, really, really sharp claws, too, and so... That, you know, Rubbermaid tubs are not that hard. I mean, they could climb up the side.
The opening at the top of the tub is like about where the seat of that black chair is over there. So there's no mouse that's going to be jumping into there.
Probably not.
Well, somebody says that, by the way, says the possums and rats have a special taste for dog food.
Oh, yeah. Oh, they loved it. Patrick worked for a year for Terminix and had to go to people's houses who were having problems with pests of various kinds. And he has a number of stories of people doing things like, I've got rats. I don't know why we have rats. And then he comes and like this one guy, he was a fisherman. And he would like dump, like just leave big buckets of chum on the floor of his garage.
Awesome.
And then there was like a pet door between the garage and the kitchen.
Right.
Like, I wonder why I've got rats in my house. Well, you're basically laying out an all-you-can-eat buffet for them and saying, oh, and by the way, here's a door into the house.
See, and that's the other thing is, and so I'm doing that thing of, and of course, I should have filmed it. If I really been thinking about this, I should have filmed my own. I should have filmed my own just insane fear, because I was walking toward the back door in the kitchen that leads out into this hallway. And again, it's 3:30 in the morning. It's raining. It's dark outside, and I hear this like, you know, and then out back, it's like I hear the whole like, you know, intermixed with what I think is squeaking noises. And, of course, I'm looking around for a flashlight, and the flashlights are all dead and dying. And so then I've got the flashlight app on my iPhone, and I'm thinking I'll use that. And then it's like I'm reaching for the handle, and every time I reach for the handle, I hear the rustling and the squeaking again. And I swear to God, it was like, I don't know what I thought was out there, but it's that thing where even as a grown man, as an adult, you were just convinced that there's some horrible H.R. Giger creation lurking out there. And I ended up never even, like, I waited until morning. I didn't even go out there because I was just, and the other thing is I knew if I opened the door and if there was a rat or a mouse and it, like, you know, even something tiny and relatively harmless, if it just jumped out or if I saw it, like, on a, that I would just squeal like a child and
also,
I would be shamed in front of everyone.
Yeah, and it's dark out there and you've got the flashlight and you shine the flashlight into the dark and then the rat looks at you and you see the, like, glowing eyes of the flashlight. You'd scream like a little girl.
You think it's Jody from the Amityville Horror.
Now, when Patrick was doing the pest thing, one of the most probably the single most common thing that he would see would be people who would have problems with mice and rats and had opened things of dog food in their garages.
Yeah. Now, see, that's the thing. See, you know, this is... All right. Well, so I got to clearly do something about that.
Yeah.
And the thing is, now I don't know if it's too late. That's the thing. Like, if they've already figured out... Like, if they remember where food is, and so now they're just going to be coming in all the time, because, like, that one time somebody left some dog food out for them.
Well, yeah. But pretty soon, if they figure out there's nothing there for them, they'll stop coming.
And I guess winter will kill them off eventually. So if I can just outlast this generation, then I'll be fine.
Unless they decide that that's a really nice warm spot to like build a nest.
Which
now
it
that
is,
they've
by the
been
way.
In there.
Here's the other great thing about it. The other great thing about this this hallway is that the hallway is because it was added on after the two houses. It's not entirely like flush. Anyway, the point is that if you're in that hallway, it is actually possible to get from that hallway down into this like crack down into on the floor that actually leads to the basement. So that's what I don't want. Yeah. I don't want it to turn into like some graveyard shift thing where suddenly my whole basement's filled with rats the size of dogs.
Well, the two main things you need to do are to make sure the dog food is sealed up and is always sealed up. And do something about that hole in the door, like patch the hole in the door, put weather stripping underneath or something so that there's no space under the door to the outside where they can get in.
If they come to exterminate, is that a thing where they just like gas the whole joint?
Not with rats. No, they put down traps and they put bait traps down and then they come back later to look for dead rats.
Somebody's saying they leave trails of urine so they can find their way back. Good. Have fun scrubbing the rat pee. Thank you.
And if you want to know if you have rats or mice, look for their poop.
All right.
Look at the size of the poop.
That's awesome. All right. So
there's probably poop in the dog food now because that's what they do.
That's not my problem. It's 503-505-6964. We'll see how impervious you are now, Max. 503-505-6964. All of that on the way to all the stuff we talked about earlier. HickWatch Top 5, Pop Culture Authority, and more. At the news desk, it is Dawn Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
Apparently you're not going to ask me how my night was, what I did. No.
I thought you said earlier that your night was just a lot of sitting around.
You didn't ask me.
Wait, hold on a second. No, hold on. So anyway, that's the whole issue with the rats. Maybe I'm conflating nights. Maybe I'm thinking of what we talked about last night or yesterday about Sunday, which is when you were just sort of sitting and finishing off the rest of your Christmas food.
I think that might be it.
Which is what I did, by the way.
Which I didn't do anything too exciting last night, but I did finally watch the season finale of Sons of Anarchy.
You finished it, so you are now caught up. You're now done with season three, Sons of Anarchy.
I am now all done with Sons of Anarchy.
I do remember that because you told me this last night, and I sent you that text message about Ali Walker. How great is Ali Walker as Agent Stahl?
Oh, I know. This show just keeps breaking my heart.
So, by the way, there are spoilers ahead.
Yes,
so,
there are spoilers ahead.
About Sons of Anarchy, if you don't want to be spoiled.
Well, what's interesting to me is that there's been a couple of things. Watching it straight through over the course of just a couple of months instead of, like, watching 3 years over 3 years. When I first started watching it, there was this sort of Shakespearean bent to it. And my initial reaction when I saw Katie Sagal's character is I wondered if there was like a Macbeth thing going on.
Right.
And then I went and looked at it and turned out, no, it's Hamlet.
Right.
And so it makes sense where they keep referring to him as the prince and all this, and she's Gertrude and, he's Hamlet. And it was interesting. One thing I noticed, they live in the town of Charming. And they waited until almost about two-thirds of the way through season three before anyone made a Prince Charming joke.
I actually remember when they did that and I sort of thought, and it had never occurred to me, but when they did it, I thought, I wonder if they had to just like make a rule that they weren't going to make that pun early on.
But knowing the story of Hamlet, it's kind of interesting because I was wondering, how far they were going to take it.
Right.
And as soon as, what's her name? The Irish Gemma. As soon as she was like reading over her old letters from Jack's father.
Right.
And the thing about, I don't fit here anymore, and I see, Gemma's becoming closer to Clay, and I went, holy crap, they are totally going the whole Hamlet route.
Right.
So it was not a big surprise at the end of the episode when, he reads Tara reads a letter, and the continuation is, and so, I don't think I'm long for this world, and I will die at the hand of my wife and my best friend. And I went, oh my God. They are continuing with the Hamlet thing, which, of course, is going to mean that at some point Tara's going to go crazy because she's Ophelia.
Yeah.
So all of this pressure of becoming a biker chick is going to make her mad. But, wow. Yeah. I started getting really frustrated with season three because for a while There was just too much going on.
Well, that
on.
Was my thing, is they rolled out too many plot lines. There was too much going on, and it became like the Shield in its lesser moments, where you had to have, like, a flow chart. I mean, it looked like you were looking at an L.A. highway map trying to follow all of the intersecting plot lines of the double crosses.
Yeah, now we're in Ireland. Okay, now we're back in California. Okay, now we're back in Ireland again. Okay, now these are the Irish guys who are doing deals with the IRA, who are running guns to the Russians, and the Russians are going to be meeting a guy in California who, like, killed the guy whose mom was the, you know, and it's like, there's this point where you just kind of go, I'm really, really glad I didn't watch this episodically one week at a time, because I would have been lost.
The other thing about it is it like, it, the problem I have with that, and this is the same thing the Shield does, is that, I won't say I get tired of it, but the thing that I find, it's almost too convenient of a plot device, plus it becomes confusing, is the temporary uneasy truce or alliance between enemies, which is a thing that the Sons of Anarchy does all the time, and so did the Shield, where, you know, it was like the One Niners and the Bizlats, you know, where it's like, yeah, where they have like some, well, this is good for both of us essay, but after this it's back, you know, it's on again. You're like, well, okay, so like for this one, for the sake of dramatic convenience, they've got this one truce going on, and a guy's going to pretend to be dead, and another guy's going to go along with it, even though it's completely illogical for him to do so.
There's no good reason for him to help them at all.
I mean, those are minor complaints, but that's the thing. It just seems a little too convenient when that happens. That smacks a little too much of the deus ex machina, but, you know, what are you going to do?
Although I'm very rarely surprised by television, and Sons of Anarchy continued to surprise me often as it went along, and the biggest surprise being, honest to God, the way they closed out that story, I didn't see it coming. I really didn't. And I realized later I should have, but I think I was just so caught up in watching it, I wasn't really analyzing and thinking about it. But I did kind of like, because I was getting really angry at Jax for continuing to trust Stahl.
Right.
And it was just really pissing me off. And then finally it's like, I'm just sitting here like, well, of course she double-crossed you. Of course she did. Why would you walk into that, you idiot? And then the way it all plays out, go, aha.
Yeah.
Ah.
Yeah, and I
don't think any of them are crafty enough to have actually pulled that off, as complicated as it was.
I got to tell
you, that would never have happened.
That's one of the things about this season that really bugged me. I mean, as great as the finale was, and I think that was probably the best episode of the season, in my opinion. But that whole thing at the, and again, we're doing some spoilers here for season three of Sons of Anarchy. But that whole thing at the end of, you know, where he pulls off the rubber mask and, no, it is you who has been fooled, and I just.
Yeah.
To me, it felt so cheap. It just felt like such a cheap. It felt like,
well,
it
particularly
just,
since apparently every single guy in the club was in on it,
especially
except, and they hadn't told Gemma.
And especially the ones who aren't too bright.
Yeah.
And, you know, the other thing about that, here's the reason I don't really care for that. A, I found that it deflated all of that tension and all of the great dramatic momentum that had been built up all throughout that episode. That at the end they get in the, you know, the paddy wagon, and then they all laugh because, you know, it was all secretly one big long con against Stahl. And I know that Kurt Sutter did an interview about it where he talked about them playing the long con and how that was the only way you could play it against Stahl, because it's the only thing she wouldn't anticipate is the long deception as opposed to the short betrayal, which I guess is true. But to me, here's...
But basically, those guys aren't that smart or that patient.
Well, and also just from a viewpoint of watching the show, just from the standpoint of being somebody in the audience, I really like shows... And The Shield did this really well, and Sons of Anarchy does it pretty well, where the guy gets painted into a corner, and then he has to realistically work himself out of it somehow. Mm-hmm. I love those situations where the guy just gets, which we were talking about, like with The Town, where the guy gets hemmed in, and he has to navigate out of these obstacles that he has put in front of himself, basically. And so I'm now going to be denied that, which I was really looking forward to.
Yeah.
The other thing is... It smacks of trying to have it both ways. And here's the other thing this season that I just cannot forgive with Sons of Anarchy. I really do love the show, and I still give the show a big thumbs up overall. I mean, it's still kind of one of the win column as far as. I mean, I'll watch it again, and I really would recommend it to other people. But there are things about it that I don't like, and the one just unforgivable twist this season was that whole beautiful, just depressing sequence where Jax was saying goodbye to his son in the shopping center because he realized that he was better off with adoptive parents. And then he sort of, you know, gets him back anyway because the parents get killed. And
then 5 minutes later.
The problem with that is it's like the writers, they want to have their cake and eat it too, where yeah. It's like they give you the emotional journey of him having to give the son away, but then they still want to have the kid around so they complete the circle and so they have dramatic payoff yeah. in the future with it. And it's like you can't have it both ways like that without it feeling false.
No, it felt really cheap.
It felt very, very cheap. It was like, it was basically like a dream sequence.
The whole thing with Trinity, the woman's daughter,
right.
being Jack's half-sister.
That was kind of hot,
and
though.
Then being attracted to each other and making out and then having to be told.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that also felt really, really unnecessary.
Yeah.
There was no real good point for that, except for the fact that they just, wouldn't this be cool if, like, he didn't know it was his sister and then they were making out.
That was a 3x5 card tacked on the corkboard in the writer's room
yeah.
that they hadn't used yet, and they went, well, we might get canceled, so we should use this incest thing we've had sitting around. I mean, and all of this sounds like we're knocking on the show, and it really is a great, great show. But the fact that it's a great show, that's why those moments kind of jar on me. So, you know, they jag on my ear when I hear that dialogue or when I see those plot twists coming. It just sort of grates on me a little bit. But how great was the final thing with the whole resolution with Jimmy and Stahl and Opie, you know, and just everybody kind of getting what they had coming to them in the end, and all in like a 35-second
yeah.
period. That thing with Opie and Stahl in the car was
yeah.
just... It was, I mean, I get chills thinking about it. It was really horrifying and wonderfully done, but really just disturbing and unsettling.
And yeah, what you said about Ali Walker in this season, that she was just amazing. One of the things about the show that I really impresses me is something I enjoyed about The Shield as well, but even more so here, is great use of women.
Yeah.
Really great use of women and great use of mature women actors as well. I mean, Ali Walker's like 49,
yeah.
you know, and Katie Sagal's in her early 50s. And yeah, you've got the eye candy chicks, you know, for the biker boys.
Who are like just porn stars, by the way.
Yeah.
yeah.
But, you know, and you've got like Tara, who's, you know, the pretty girlfriend of the you know, of Jack's and yada yada. But there's actually, you know, the woman who plays the administrator she works with,
right.
whose story ended up becoming much more complicated
like
than
some
you
Kathy Bates looking
ever
woman.
Imagined
yeah.
at the beginning. And yeah, and Katie Sagal and Ali Walker both turning in just really amazing work over the course
well,
of the season.
And they let themselves look a little grubby. That's the other thing. Like, you know, they don't, you know, like you watch those shows where, you know, like Lost sort of comes to mind, where it's like the women still look impossibly hot, like 3 years in, like her lipstick. I remember watching, this is the thing that bugs me about The Mist. When I watch The Mist, and it's like, what's her name, the blonde chick, who actually, the blonde woman who was then on Walking Dead.
Yeah.
You watch The Mist, like, they've been in the store for 4 days, and her makeup is still flawless, and that's the one thing Lara pointed out, and now it just jumps off the screen every time
oh,
I see
yeah.
it. But with, you watch Sons of Anarchy, and The Shield was the same way, where it's like they cast unconventional looking women by, you know, they're not beautiful by Hollywood standards, and sometimes not, you know, not beautiful by most standards. They're just plain looking women. They're normal people. And then they will let themselves just go all to hell over the course of an episode.
Okay.
So that Tara chick is hot though. She's kind of weird looking for television.
She is, but also she has that weird actressy thing that, like, there was a scene in that last episode in the finale where they were outside and she's sort of like in full sunlight.
Right.
And you realize that her eyebrows are like way overly plucked and her skin is just sort of impossibly glossy. And you realize she's like seriously done for camera work.
She's sort of strange looking, though.
Yeah.
I mean, she's got crazy eyes, for one thing. If you look at her, she's got, and maybe the eyebrows help that or hurt that, depending on your point of view. But she's got a little bit of the crazy expression going on.
Yeah.
So I'm glad you're caught up. And how great was that final thing? How great was the that cover of Hey Hey My My?
Yes.
That they played over the end.
Yes.
I mean, that was really that was quite something. That
yeah,
show
the
has
music,
an excellent use of music.
They do, and the music in this particular season was just outstanding as well.
Do you hold with my assessment that season 2 was the best so far?
Yeah, yeah. I do.
I mean,
I do.
The great thing about it,
season 3 was good, but it got really messy, and like you said, like we've talked about, it got way overly complicated.
I like the fact that Adam Arkin is still alive and out there, though, so he might come back at some point. Zobel the Nazi, so he might be returning yeah. to charming.
Not so Henry Rollins.
No, and not so Hale. He's you know, killed right at the outset. So well, so as you were catching up, and then I'll keep this short because we've been talking for like an hour. I am nearly caught up with House, so I'm halfway through season 6. And here's the thing about this show. Is that House has now officially reached the point, I feel like, where the show has been on long enough, and I'm watching it on a compressed timeline, but House has been on long enough, it seems, where the people who are writing the show now are a different group of people that were writing the show at the beginning. So, like, you've gone through an entire... There was now, like, a whole generation removed from, like, the show's roots. Because the people who are writing the season six episodes seem to have never watched the earlier seasons of the show. And they don't really... And they never spoke with any of the people who wrote the earlier seasons of the show. Because... because House is gone, you know, he went crazy.
Yeah.
He went crazy. And by the way, you know... It is only because I really love Hugh Laurie and the way he and you know and the performances in that show are so great that I forgive them ending season five with what is effectively a Patrick Duffy "I'm in the shower, it's all a dream" episode about why he bonked Cuddy and then didn't.
Yeah,
you know. So
yeah.
That long and hard.
Yeah, that sucked.
You know, and it's like the going crazy is just one step above dream episode. I mean, because they're basically the same thing. It's just a dream in his head that comes from being nuts, not from being asleep.
Yeah.
So that's just this side of Unforgivable. The other thing is, has anybody considered the possibility that it is, in fact, Princeton Plainsboro Hospital that is killing people? Because it's like vacationing with Jessica Fletcher, man. Everybody
Oh, yeah.
Who goes there, well, there hasn't been a documented case of this bizarre disease in 700 years. Well, it looks like you should call the press then. You know, it's like everything that they've cured. Yeah.
Granted, the whole point is that it's this research hospital, and the reason you end up with Dr. House is supposed to be... originally,
he's the best.
At the beginning of the show, when they first started, yes, he dealt with unusual cases. Now it's apparently people just come in the hospital for a hysterectomy, and something goes horribly wrong, and he just happens to be the doctor.
Yeah.
It's kind of like on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, where, you know, where Xander... By season five, Xander was able to kill vampires with a pencil.
He's a superhero.
You know, so why do we need a slayer? So, yeah, in this case, it's like everybody. It's like, I had a hangnail, and I was in the clinic. Oh, God, I started gushing blood out of my eyes.
Right.
Well, take him to House, and then House will almost kill him six different times before they figure out, oh, it was something you were allergic to in your bathroom.
Interferon, but that'll kill him. Well, if we don't kill him, the cancer will. You know, and you're like, okay. But I'm not even bitching about the formula of it, because I realize that
I'm in it for the House Wilson relationship and that stuff, you know.
It's like, you know, and House is basically, it is the best of both worlds when you look at it, because it's like the Simpsons one time where they were doing, like, you know, the new fall lineup is here, it's medical cops, and like House is medical cops. I mean, House is a cop show that just happens to take place in a hospital, and the enemy is a disease. I mean, that's all it is. As we've noted, it's a Sherlock Holmes show set in the hospital. So I can get with the formula, because murder mysteries, which it basically is, a murder mystery has a formula, and that's fine. My whole thing is just, like, the show is now so internally inconsistent. I liked the fact that he was in the crazy house, even though I didn't find those episodes all that well written. I liked the fact that he was in a mental institution with Andre Brower. I thought that was sort of interesting.
Yeah.
Now he's just back to being, you know, like the bad boy and the whatever. But the other thing is that now he's back to, you know, he's complaining, he's bitching about being, he's bitching about the pain in his leg all the time. And that's his excuse for being a jerk and for, you know, like for nearly going back on Vicodin. And every time he gets called out on just being basically an ass, he says, well, you know, you'd feel like an ass too if, you know, your leg was just dipped in kerosene and lit on fire 24 hours a day. And I say to myself, wasn't it just last season, and it was, when he discovered that he could go on methadone and it cured his leg pain without any of the Vicodin problems? The only reason he didn't want to go on methadone is because he didn't want to lose his edge, which now isn't a problem because he's gone to the mental institution and Andre Brower has cured him and he's going to be a better person. There is now no reason for him not to go back to the solution that he himself discovered like 2 months ago. I mean, that's what I want to... I just want to step into the television and go, like, hey, do you remember, like, way back, like, a couple weeks ago when you discovered the solution to this yourself and you are now forgetting it for the purposes of dramatic expedience?
Yeah.
So that's the thing that I've gotten really frustrated with. But you know what? But soon I'm going to be caught up. And then I can quit watching again until season seven is done.
Yeah.
Because it's just my sense of completism keeping me going at this point.
Sean Patrick... Flannery, is that his name? The guy who plays Wilson?
Yes, yes. The Dead Poet Society guy.
Yes, I read an interview with him a few years ago, and somebody had asked him, it's like, if he found it frustrating that he didn't have as much time on the show. You know, that ostensibly he's like a secondary character,
right.
But he doesn't really have as much time on the show. And he's kind of like, you know, I get paid the same whether I work an hour a day or like 5 hours a day. Hugh has to be there every single day for like 12 hours a day. I show up like 2 days a week, do my lines, and go home. I pull him down the same paycheck.
Oh, yeah.
I'm happy.
Oh, yeah. Doesn't matter if the episode's about him or not. His paycheck remains unchanged. Well, that was like my thing with when Rob Lowe was complaining about that with The West Wing. Because, you know, The West Wing was originally going to be about Rob Lowe. It was going to be when The West Wing was first created and launched, when they wrote the pilot and filmed the pilot, Martin Sheen was only going to appear a couple times a season. He was just going to be like special guest star Martin Sheen. The show was going to be about Sam Seaborn, the Rob Lowe character. And so that's why Lowe signed on. He's like, well, television's a step down, but if it's going to be about me, okay. And then he signs on to The West Wing, which is like one of the most celebrated shows in the history of the medium. I mean, it won, I think, 5 Emmys in a row, you know, for Best Dramatic Series. Also, again, you're making the same. It doesn't matter whether the episode is about Sam or whether it's about Josh Lyman or whether it's about, you know, some guy, some congressional page. You're getting paid the same. And also, you know, like you're working with Martin Sheen on a show written by Aaron Sorkin. And, but you know, that's why he walked, is because he got sick of the show not being about him. Yeah. So, you know.
It's not like his career was in such a great place when he took that role that it was a step down.
And then he left you to the show Lion's Den.
Oh, yeah.
Well chosen, sir. By the way, it's 2:20, just in case anybody's wondering how long we've been talking about television. I'm glad you reminded me, though, because I somehow spaced the whole thing that you finished season of Sons of Anarchy. So what are you going to be watching now?
I don't know. I mean, because we're in this sort of dead zone of TV at the moment where everything's in reruns. And I think I'm all caught up on, like, pretty much every single thing that I want to watch, unless I dip into those big files, those big file folders full of episodes of The Wire that are still sitting on my computer that I haven't watched yet.
You'll know, by the way, that I've quit asking you to watch The Wire, because it's like, you're either going to do it or not, and it's like, at this point, I want you to watch it because you're watching it. Like, I don't want to nag you into it, because then you're going to, you know, because then you're going to be watching it through a jaundiced eye.
Well, I think what'll happen, though, is the same thing that happened with Sons of Anarchy, that, like, I was like, Sons of Anarchy, I couldn't get into it. And then, of course, once I did, because Patrick asked me that, I, like, finished the season finale last night, and I was like, okay, that was it. Season finale of season 3, Sons of Anarchy, and Patrick looked at me and said, so what are you going to be obsessed with now?
Yeah, well, that's, see, and that is the thing, I mean, you know, watch it, don't watch it, but I mean, but I will say, the only thing I will say about The Wire is that you really are, you must watch from episode 1. For all intents and purposes, because, you know, and don't do it, God forbid, Ryan, why were you just like, watch like 2 episodes halfway through season 3 and then said it made no sense? And I was like, well, of course it makes no sense. It's one story, essentially. So, yeah, if you're going to watch it, you got to watch it from the beginning. But I mean, watch, don't watch. We should open this package.
We should.
So if you all were hearing
us. Do you have a knife?
I have some keys. If you heard us talk during Legion of News during the noon hour, Seamus actually sent us a text message during Legion of News and said, my brother is outside your studio door right now leaving you a package, which was equal parts sort of great and creepy. But this is the Christmas present that he was ostensibly going to deliver on Friday, and he was not able to. By the way, I still got to pick that thing up at the post office box. We still got a guy, the present from a guy sitting at our P.O. box. So I'll try to bring that in tomorrow.
Yeah.
All right, so you are opening the box from Seamus right now.
I am.
I should reveal at this point that I know what's inside, so.
Oh. All right. I don't. Opening.
Okay, this is a cardboard box being opened right now.
And here's another box inside this box.
I swear to God, we'll get to news here in just a moment.
Oh, it's an Edge brownie pan.
That's what I'm saying. It is the all Edge brownie pan.
There's 2 of them, one for you and one for me.
That's right.
Oh, all Edge brownie pan.
I think he's heard us rhapsodize about it for so long that he grew sick of it. And he was just, he was tired of hearing us kvetch about how we didn't own it.
Oh boy. Now I can make brownies, and every brownie will have edges.
That's right. So I'm going to go home tonight, and I'm going to leave this on the counter with a note inside saying, you know what you have to do. So,
Wait, you can't make your own damn brownies?
No. Well, I mean, I could, but they're not going to be as good as if Laura made them. I mean, what would be the point? I make substandard. I'm not the cook she is, and so there would be no, because that would be bad for her, and it'd be bad for me. You know what I mean? There is nothing to be gained by me making the brownies at home, because then she's going to have terrible brownies to eat, and so am I.
It adds 2 chewy edges to every individual serving, it says on the box. Fits standard box mixes with no adjustments necessary. Circulates heat evenly to every brownie for more consistent results. Durable nonstick coating and round, easy-to-clean corners. Heavy-gauge cast aluminum construction with recessed handles. And it includes a nylon spatula and brownie recipes.
Excellent. Oh, and 13 left the show, by the way, which is the other reason it's not as interesting. Because she's, not 13, but what's her name? Cameron.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I found her, you know, she was actually one of the most interesting characters to me.
They kind of keep, yeah, they kept, they had that whole bringing them back because they were working in a different part of the hospital and then them coming and going thing. And...
Well, not even. So I'll let you know when I'm caught up with that. But okay. Let me know what you watch next. So after I finish House, then I'm going to watch the series Jekyll from the BBC. So the BBC did like a 6-episode TV series of Jekyll, but I do believe it is set in modern day.
I've been meaning to watch that. I enjoyed the BBC Sherlock very, very much.
All right. Somebody wants to know if you're watching Breaking Bad yet. No, she's not.
No, I'm not.
By the way, they're marathoning it. You know, all this, you know, they started, I think they started last week, actually, doing 2 episodes every Wednesday. Doesn't matter. All right. At the news desk, it's Dawn Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
Authorities in Volusia County, Florida, want to make it clear that 911 is for emergencies only.
I'm sorry, where?
Florida.
They want to make it clear that 911 is not a joke.
Right. Two people were arrested on Sunday for making calls that the sheriff's office said weren't quite of an emergency nature. You can see pictures of both of these people in our visual aids area. Authorities said 44-year-old Cynthia Colson of Deltona, Florida, called 911 several times after she wasn't satisfied with the length of her nails after a manicure. Deputy said Colson called 911 at least 4 times, twice after her original 911 call, asking when deputies would arrive at the nail salon, and a 4th time when the deputy was in the store trying to settle the dispute over payment.
Excellent.
Colson got into a fight with the nail technician and was slightly hurt.
That is awesome.
Then she was arrested.
I am looking at this right here, by the way. So the these are the 911 abusers. So now, wow, what is up with her neck?
I don't know. She has yes.
What is?
She should be more angry about her neck than her nails.
Her nails. Seriously, there's something really strange going on with the way this woman's head is attached to the rest of her body.
Well, the other fellow in that photo,
Snuffy,
that's Lawrence Godier, 61, who goes by the name of Gator.
Yeah, I was just going to say, because Godier does not seem like this guy's name. He doesn't seem like he could. But Gator does seem, in fact,
like this guy's name. He looks like a gator.
He really does.
He has a history of using 911 as his personal request hotline. The sheriff's office said Godier has called them 16 times since November, requesting business cards and checking up on deputies.
Oh, fantastic. By the way, did you see the other visual aid that is in the photo album?
No.
Or in the visual every day. So if you get a chance in the Dropbox, I don't have to do it now, but I did have this story about the woman who beat her parents with a Christmas tree.
Oh, okay.
The thing about it is the story itself is pretty straightforward. The mugshot is really awesome, though. So that's we'll want to do the story at some point. It's in the Dropbox. I'll print it up.
Okay.
But it really is all worth it just so you can have the visual aid like in your head. You can be picturing this as the story sort of unfolds. So we'll get to that later on. Here's Dawn Taylor.
A grandfather spent 3 days driving around southern England before he was found on Christmas Day after his wife's flight was switched from Heathrow Airport to Gatwick Airport during last week's travel chaos. Mohammed Belizrak. Yeah, Mohammed Belizrak, 72, is believed to have clocked nearly 2,000 miles as he desperately tried to find his way home after dropping off his wife at Gatwick on December 23rd. What should have been a 120-mile journey lasting 2.5 hours became a 66-hour marathon. Mr. Belizrak ended up sleeping in his car before trying again and again to work out his route back to Trowbridge in Wiltshire. He was eventually found on Christmas Day, still at the wheel of his Peugeot 307, when he triggered a police camera armed with number plate recognition and was flagged down. Mr. Belizrak had driven his wife to Heathrow and then to Gatwick so she could catch a flight to visit her family in Morocco. Closed-circuit TV footage showed him leaving Gatwick at 8 p.m. Thursday, but he disappeared after that. After his family contacted police, Thames Valley Police fed his car details into the automatic number plate recognition computer,
which is creepy,
and discovered that he had been in numerous towns, including Berkshire, Buckinghamshire, and Oxfordshire.
So is he crazy? I mean, is there some sort of mental infirmity going on? Okay, so...
After his family contacted police, Thames Valley Police Sergeant Joe Spencer, who led the hunt, said, "We contacted other forces with no success and then asked for the automatic number plate recognition systems to be activated to see if anyone spotted him." His ordeal finally ended at 2 p.m. on Christmas Day when his car number plate activated an ANPR camera in Oxford. Mr. Belizrak, who had left his mobile phone at home, said, "3 times I went to London and 3 times I went back to the airport. I was a little bit frightened because I would stop and ask for directions, but nobody would give me any. They would just say that they didn't know where I was going or I was going too far away. I had my sat-nav, but I was still lost. It kept on taking me all over the place. I will never go out without my mobile phone again. I blame my sat-nav for what happened.
Okay. You know, can I just say, when we were in Provo, Laura and I rented this car. It was the same car that had the, quote, flex fuel on it. And it had the OnStar thing. And I don't know what it is about me, but when I get into a car with OnStar, I am incapable of not, like, pressing the button. I, even though I know that it connects me to the OnStar operator.
Oh.
I don't know why. It's a thing that I just do. I think I need to confirm to myself that it works. So that if I am ever, like, stuck in a snowdrift somewhere so that coyotes don't eat my bones, so, you know, that I know that it actually is going to function properly. But then, of course, you know, they answer and they immediately think that you're, like, you know, they think that you have some sort of an emergency or something, and then I always have to apologize about it. But the thing about the OnStar and stuff and the sat-nav is that now it's like whenever I am in a car without that stuff, I just feel so alone and helpless and terrified that something is going to happen. You know, that it's like with it, it's like having the GPS. Now, whenever I don't have the GPS, I feel like I'm just some sort of cripple whose braces have been taken away.
Well, you and I have talked about this before. Like you, I tend to be directionally challenged.
Yes.
I only know how to get places that I have been before. And I get everywhere by visual cues. I don't remember the names of streets. I've lived in Portland for 20 years, and I still can't remember what's north of Division and what's right. south of Division. And so having the GPS on my iPhone just these last couple of months has been wonderful. But the thing is, I take it personally if it gets mad at me. And I realize that it's not actually getting mad at me, but it feels that way. Like, if you have the thing calculated where you're supposed to go, but you decide, actually, no, GPS, it's actually better if I go this way, or you just turn the wrong way.
Construction or something.
Or something. And, yeah. And it starts going, make a U-turn at the next possible place. Make a U-turn. And I feel like, honestly, I know that it's saying it exactly the same way, but to me, it just sounds like it's getting more and more strident. Make a U-turn, idiot.
Well, they probably, you know, at some point, they will probably create one of those that just escalates in volume level or that just, you know, that just takes over your car. You know, once Google is manufacturing everything, because it will just, it's stupid human, and it will just decide that you're going the wrong way.
But honestly, the night that I went to the Mormon Annie Get Your Gun at that LDS church out in the middle of nowhere in Hillsboro, and I took the wrong turn out of the parking lot, and I was on some, like, farming road in the backwoods somewhere in the pitch black. Man, that GPS was like this beacon light of safety in the darkness that made me feel like everything was going
to
be okay.
I've had that same experience going out to Malala. I went to visit a friend of mine who lives in Malala a couple years back, and it was like in the middle of the night, and it's like, you know, Malala's a pretty, I mean, you can get lost there during the day, you know, with the sun directly overhead, but at night, I mean, there's nothing. Like, there's no street lights. There's no, you know, I mean, you're not passing a 7-Eleven. There's nothing out there. But the great thing about having the GPS and I have the TomTom is that it's like having night vision, you know, because you look out the windshield and all you see is a blackness. But then you look up and there's a perfect representation of where you are, where the road is, and the surrounding area, like done in these primary colors. And it is like having some weird, like, you know, it is like having some weird night spec thing that you've put on, you know, like, you know, that just guides you through. It's also weird, though, how the iPhone is completely, to tie this into the GPS, how it's completely screwed your sense of pricing. So we've talked about the app thing that, because, you know, like, I'm an early adopter. And so our first, we got the very first TomTom when it came out, and it was like, I mean, it was like $340 or something, or $370. And I've had that for, I don't know, maybe 6 or 7 years now. And it's like, it's kind of huge and it's old and, you know, it still works. But I mean, it's, you know, but it's like the, but because it's the first generation, like the maps don't update. So if anything has changed since then, it's now out of date. Like it doesn't know where Cesar Chavez Boulevard is and whatever. But so it was like $375. Yet I resist getting the TomTom app for the iPhone because it's $26. You know, $26—that's highway robbery. And so I just refuse.
I think the GPS app that I use on my phone, and it's been great. I mean, even when we went to Christmas Mountain Trees, and you said some of the GPS stuff couldn't find
right.
it got me right on the right road right away. And I, honest to God, I think the app I'm using was free.
Oh, so the one I'm using is free. It's the one from MapQuest, and it's you know, and yeah, I didn't pay for it at all because I just can't fathom. That's the problem with pricing all the apps at 99 cents is that now anything that is like $1.99 or more seems exorbitant.
Oh, I know. I got a lovely gift from Thomas Gill of some iTunes money. And I decided I wanted to play this game, Spore, where you like play this little guy and you evolve and you do something. And I think it was like $1.99. And I had to actually think about it for a moment. And then I said, Jesus Christ, Don, this is a game that when it came out last year for the PC was like $40.
Right.
You know, I don't want to spend $1.99 to play it on my iPhone.
And plus, the company spent $750,000 to make it whatever. Well, it's like, you know what? I got that word lens thing that just magically turned Spanish to English.
Yeah.
Which is just like. Which just blows my mind. I mean, it's like, and it's like an imperfect technology, and it's, you know, it doesn't work 100% accurately, and you know, whatever. But to me, like, that's less the. I mean, you know the thing I'm talking about. Have you seen it? And it's like, if anybody has not seen this, because I think right now it is only for the iPhone. It's an app you download, and like, you just using the camera, you just look at like a sign in Spanish where it says like, you know, el baño es, you know, es abierto, and then you just point the camera at it, and then in the same font. It magically just appears as English. The bathroom is closed. And I mean, and I looked at that and I thought, okay, the really weird thing about this is not that it's magically turning Spanish to English. It's not that it's matching the font. It's not that it's doing it instantly. It's not that, like, it's doing it on my phone. It's that it cost me $4.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. It cost me $4. And the thing, and it, I mean, it doesn't work perfectly, but it works. And so that tells you, like, well, what is the thing they're going to have, like, you know, like 10 years from now? What is that thing going to be capable of doing? You know, and it'll probably cost me $1.99 at that point. It just blows your mind when you think about, like, the first TiVo I had, which held 14 hours of programming and cost, I don't know, it was like $600 or something. But it's like now, you know, the TiVo is like $190 and it holds 200 hours of programming and is HD and has like a DVD burner.
Well, I was thinking about the enormous amount of money I spent for I think I spent $450 for additional memory for my Power Mac that I bought at one point. And the Mac itself cost a fortune, and everything else cost a fortune. And then just to add, like, a little bit of memory, like a few hundred megabytes of memory, it cost me like an additional $450. And the other day I bought this little, you know, little thumb drive thing, little flash drive I'm carrying around on my lanyard around my neck, which holds 4 gigabytes of information, and it cost me $19.99, and it's the size of my thumbnail.
It's just, it's unnerving.
I like living in the future.
I like living here, but it's almost unnerving to think about, like, what it will be like, you know, what Art Bell calls the quickening, how it will, what it's going to be like in 25 years, presumably we'll still be here and just be completely weirded out by everything.
I'm hoping, considering if I'm actually still alive, I'm hoping it'll be like WALL-E. And I'll get to just be hugely fat and float around just in a seat all the time, looking at everything on a screen and drinking my meals out of
just
a cup.
Just being spongy.
Yeah, that's what I know that was supposed to be a bad thing in the movie.
Well, we're kind of headed that way.
But
now,
honestly, I saw it and I thought, that's my dream.
You know what I did while I was watching House last night? Just ate more Cranky on more ice cream. So, I mean, I've reached that point, by the way, officially now where I have eaten so much. It's not even that it's bad food. It's just food that I typically don't eat because it's very, you know, it's like basically just meat and cheese and Triscuits and ice cream. I have now, but it's like I've purchased it. And you know how I am with food. I purchased it. I got to eat it. Like, I can't throw stuff away. So I have now eaten so much of my holiday food. I have been on the holiday diet for so long now that, A, I just am constantly just feeling about half nauseated. And also, I've just got that. This is so gross. But I've just now got that thing where it's like, my teeth never quite feel clean, no matter how often I brush them.
Yeah.
They always kind of feel gritty, like I'm just about to hurl.
I made that really quick 360-degree shift into, or 180, I guess would be the
give
correct
me some lettuce.
Into eating healthy. Like, I'll have oatmeal for breakfast, and I'll eat salad for lunch, and all that sort of thing. And you may have noticed me making, like, displeased faces earlier when I was eating this. I would like to say to the fine people at Cozy Shack, who make an excellent prepackaged pudding product, by the way, your sugar-free chocolate pudding is ass.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's just really not very good because it's sugar-free chocolate pudding, or if it's because I went to sugar-free chocolate pudding after living for a week on cookies and fudge.
Well, that's the other thing, is you've gone from 60 to zero in like half a second there.
Yeah.
So, all right, here is Don Taylor at the news desk.
An autistic British schoolboy has been granted court approval to begin treatment to become a woman. On the proviso, the teenager has his sperm frozen in case he wants to have children in the future. Ruling on an emergency application by his parents in the family court, Justice Linda Dessau backed the wishes of the 16-year-old, who was given the pseudonym O, to begin drug treatment before puberty fully takes hold. Justice Dessau said the boy, who suffers from mild Asperger's syndrome, was mature enough to know what he wanted. She added that her decision was backed by his parents, six specialists, and the boy's independent lawyer. The judge said the boy would have his sperm collected and stored because of concerns the female hormones would affect his ability to have children. The judge's decision is not unprecedented. 6 years ago, the court sparked outrage when it allowed a 13-year-old girl named Alex from a troubled family to begin hormone treatment to become a man. Last year, Alex, then 17, was given permission to have a double mastectomy, and in another case, a 12-year-old girl was also allowed to take hormones to live life as a man. In the case of O, the court heard that he comes from a loving family who adore and support him. His 14-year-old sister, whose clothes he secretly dressed in, was also supportive. The judge has not only suppressed his name, which is mandatory, but those of his lawyers, his doctors, the hospital where he'll have treatment, the city in which the court sat, and the file number of the case.
Okay. It is 503-505-6964, 503-505-6964. So in just a moment, we'll have today's installment of Pop Culture Authority. Today we answer the question, what is up with the green machine? What is that all about? Because we had this conversation last Friday with or last Thursday with Anna Griffin about the toys you always coveted or wanted for Christmas but did not quite receive, and occasionally your parents would kind of get it right. Sometimes they would get it completely wrong, and then sometimes you would just never get any variation of the thing. And so it is with the green machine, because as I said, we only ever knew one kid on our block that ever had it, and we ever actually got to see him ride it. So we have no idea what the handles in the middle even do. So we'll do a Pop Culture Authority about the green machine here in just a few. We'll get your top five coming up here in just a bit, and Hick Watch still to come as well. You are listening to the Rick Emerson radio program. Are ye prepared with your...
I am, if you'll hand me the pages off of the printer.
All right, awesome. So I'll tell you what, we will get to the Pop Culture Authority here in just a second. We're going to take this moment to talk about Squires Electric. Find out more about them at squireselectric.com. They help bring you today's Pop Culture Authority as well as the rest of today's amusements and entertainments. Squireselectric.com is their website. You can also call them. It's 503-252-1609, 503-252-1609. 1609. Here's what we had to do. We had to have Joe Squires on the show to do like a top five or something at some point, because
yeah.
he's been asking to come in and just sort of like, you know, sit, like hang out in the studio or just sort of watch us do the show or something, which I guess he did. He did that, I think, with Greg and Sarah recently, because he was he wanted to come by and watch the show happen. And we said, sure, you know, just pick a day that works for you. And then it's like he was, you know, because they're always getting called out to places. And I guess the holidays are really busy for those guys. So he ended up just instead, I think he just watched an episode of Fun Employment Radio, because they were taping it at like 5 or 6 in the evening. And and I think it was one of their rooftop shows as well, where he went up there and they just uncorked like a huge bottle of whiskey. And I think he just hadn't drank himself into a coma while they were doing the broadcast. So he said that was a great deal of fun. So we'll have to... So we'll have to have him come by at some point, and we'll have him do a top five. But Squires Electric, owned by Mr. Joe Squires, they've been around for more than a decade. And, of course, he is from this area himself, so he knows a lot of the conditions of the houses here. And you get houses that are built, you know, relatively early, compared to recent builds. And they're not sometimes equipped with the electrical, with the wiring setup you need. The infrastructure is just not where you need it to be. The Ethernet wiring is not installed at all sometimes if it's an old enough house. And, you know, if you are going to be working from home or if you've got a business, it's going to be moving into a new building. You want to make sure that all that stuff is up to snuff, and it's going to be able to, help you communicate effectively with the outside world, and especially as you become spongier and begin to be ferried around on a sort of magical floating pad. 503-252-1609 is how you can contact them, or SquiresElectric.com. They are licensed, bonded, and insured electrical contractors, installers, and supervisors. SquiresElectric.com or 503-252-1609. Squires Electric.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
Do you have the audio file for the...
This is the audio file for the...
Green machine.
For the Pop Culture Authority.
Yes.
So let me make sure that it's the... same one. Is this the... The spot?
Yes.
All right. Yes, I am. Rick Emerson is prepared with that, Don Taylor.
Okay.
Are you ready?
I will cue you when we need that.
All right, ladies and gentlemen. Still to come today, we got your Hick Watch, we got your top five and more. This is Don Taylor with Pop Culture Authority.
What's the deal with the green machine?
From the Emerson News Network, this is Pop Culture Authority.
I'm Don Taylor. Freedom to a child is primarily expressed through motion. We learn to walk, and the first thing we do is propel ourselves as fast as we can, even if that means falling on our faces. As soon as we're set inside or on top of anything with wheels, we've taken another step towards vehicular autonomy. The tricycle got us around as small tykes, but a few years later, we wanted something with a bit more oomph, something that would go faster, look cooler, maybe even spin out and skid without sending us again to the emergency room. But until the very end of the 1960s, such a device didn't exist. Then the Marx Toy Company debuted the Big Wheel in 1969, one of the most iconic and memorable American toys ever made. Sadly, though, the Big Wheel was designed for smaller children, and once boys turned 8 or 9, they'd outgrown the Big Wheel, if not physically, then socially. Which is why, in 1975, Marx brought out a slightly bigger, decidedly more mature, three-wheeled vehicle for older kids, the Green Machine.
This is the Green Machine.
Green Machine.
Woo! 8, 9, 10 years old, old enough for Green Machine, a racer for guys who like a ride that's really fast. Six shift controls, swivel action rear wheels, twist, turn, and spin like wild.
Green Machine.
What a ride.
Yeah.
Green Machine with stick shift steering, some assembly required. Green Machine by Marx.
The Green Machine, besides being larger than the Big Wheel, had a more sophisticated steering system designed specifically to facilitate those gravel-spitting skids, which were, let's face it, the whole point of the thing. Instead of front-wheel handlebar steering, the Green Machine had two shifting handles on either side connected by metal rods to a pivoting rear axle. Pull one all the way back and slam the other one forward, and you could slide full speed on the wide plastic tires all the way across your parents' driveway. Because the Green Machine was made from the outset for kids who wanted to court injury, Marx marketed it to parents of male children, the TV ad showing testosterone-drenched little boys doing donuts in front of their suburban ranch homes with nary a girl in sight. Which isn't to say that girls didn't ride their brothers' Green Machines when the boys weren't looking. It was just a much harder sell for Susie to get mom and dad to cough up for a hardcore action trike in the days when women's equality was still fodder for jokes during Carson's monologue. The Green Machine was out of production for many years, and in 1993, Empire Industries bought the rights from Marx and named it the Big Wheel Sidewinder. There was also a Green Machine variant called the Blue Max. Today, Huffy owns the rights and produces a number of Green Machine models, and a pink machine for girls, with features like steel frames and even water cannons. Running around $100, they're still pricey enough to make any kid the envy of the neighborhood if they're lucky enough to own one, and the bearer of endless bruises and scrabbed knees to exhibit his badges of courage.
The final word on the only knowledge that matters. Pop Culture Authority from the Emerson News Network.
Every day seems a little longer.
listening to the Emerson News Network. News Network.
Then. It is the Rick Emerson radio program. Thank you for joining us. How's your All Edges brownie pan over there?
Oh, it's awesome. It's hefty. The thing is really solid. I mean, they were saying it was, you know, some kind of like solid aluminum something. It's quite hefty. They also mentioned, and this is absolutely true, that you don't have to just make brownies with it. You can make anything that you would like to have a soft, moist center and a nice crispy thing. Anything you like the corners and edges of. You could make coffee cake. You could make cobbler.
Now, they actually make a lasagna pan, which I imagine, does it have to be glass or something?
No.
Because they make an all-edges lasagna pan now, and I'm wondering if it's exactly, if like the same pan in a different box.
I think it's probably the same thing, only bigger, that the pieces would be bigger.
So it would not be as narrow.
Yeah, because a brownie you want a brownie to be about 2 inches by 2 inches, but an actual serving of lasagna would be like at least twice that.
All right.
So it's probably just it's exactly the same thing, only bigger.
You are listening to the Rick Emerson radio program. Still to come, we got your Hick Watch. Also do today's top five. Listener Ken was talking about my fondness for the Cheap Trick song Surrender, and he also wanted to know if I preferred the Live at Budokan version to the album version, and the answer is no. I actually prefer the studio version. I mean, the Budokan version is great, but I really prefer the studio version because they just had that, because it had that, like, that sort of Beatles ELO, like, sheen on everything. I mean, Cheap Trick is a great live band, which you would not know, Don Taylor.
No, I've never seen. Although, I loved that song for a very long time. since, as I mentioned before, my very first boyfriend was a drummer and he was a big Kiss fan. And I never really liked Kiss that much, but he introduced me to Cheap Trick and I fell immediately in love. And I loved that song for years and without actually knowing what Rolling Numbers was.
I always assumed that it meant that it was a drug reference.
I get, well, it is. Rolling Numbers, they're rolling joints.
Right, that's what I
figured. But I didn't know, they were on the couch and they were rolling. So I just kept thinking, I thought it was some reference to them making out. Like mom and dad were rolling around on the couch making out.
Right.
It was kind of like the whole Eagles song, you know, there are lines on the mirror, lines on her face. It was like, you know, it was like probably, you know, a couple of decades later, you know, after the first time I ever heard the song, that all of a sudden in the car one day I went, oh, that's about drugs.
Oh, it's a cocaine reference.
Yeah.
I get it.
So, yeah, I can't even remember when it was that at some point I was listening to Surrender and Rolling Numbers,
right.
Mom. Oh, Rolling Joint. Oh, that's what that's about.
Well, that's like the with the Honky Talk Women. There's that when I was a kid and I heard that line where Jagger says, I met a divorcee and met a gin-soaked barroom queen. And No. It's late when he says, I met a divorcee in New York City. I must have put up some kind of a fight. And the headline about she blew my nose and then she blew my mind. And I had no idea what blow my nose meant.
Yeah.
I mean, you could tell from the way he said it that it was something naughty. But I just didn't know what it was.
Well,
it was
yeah,
like
you make,
12, you know.
Yeah, you're a kid. And so you kind of fill in the blanks. Like you think, oh, he must have had a really bad cold.
Right.
So I always had this image of Mick Jagger, this woman like tucking him into bed and giving him NyQuil and taking care of him. And then, like, doing something naughty to him. Like,
excellent.
You know, as a child, hearing the song, I heard it through the grapevine.
Right.
And I lived next door to people who had a grape arbor in their backyard. And so in my head, I always thought it was a song about a man who heard people whispering over on the other side of a grape arbor about, like, his woman fooling around. Because I'd never heard
a man
the phrase.
In a vineyard.
I had never heard the phrase through the grapevine.
Right.
So I thought maybe like they didn't see him because like all the grapevines were covering up the grape arbor and then he overheard them talking.
Let me just say this one thing about the Eagles. The Eagles are one of those bands that I have this whole theory about the evolution of pop culture, which is the stages that something goes through, which is that it is popular, then it is reviled, then it is campy, then it is acknowledged as great. So it's like the Bee Gees are doing that. You know, and I know that you're
Hall
not.
Notes.
I think it's that you. Was it you that's not a Bee Gees fan?
No, I'm not a Bee Gees fan.
Okay, but it's. But I think Dolly Parton is doing that right now, too.
Hall & Oates is going through that right now.
Hall & Oates.
People are starting to rediscover Hall & Oates.
Barry Manilow.
Yep.
You know, loved, reviled, then kitschy, then everybody kind of goes, F it, he's great, you know? And same thing with.
Neil Diamond.
And it's not just music, it's every bit of pop culture. Anything that eventually becomes. Anything that becomes just irrefutably, undeniably, indisputably great, you know, it usually goes through those four stages. But I think the thing with the Eagles is that I can't really tell what stage they are in with the population as a whole. I can never really get a fix on it because the Eagles is one of those bands that because of their association with classic rock and the fact that you get a song like Hotel California or whatever that gets so overplayed and like that Glenn Frey is a douchebag. You think that maybe they're still in the reviled stage, but then it's like you talk to like every guy, you talk to like every like anybody. The Eagles are one of those bands that if you get a guy in a bar late at night, he will inevitably put on an Eagles record and begin sobbing uncontrollably about like a girlfriend he used to have. Or if you talk to country guys, guys in country bands love the Eagles. They freaking love the Eagles, and so do I.
The Eagles are still in that period though where I think I think that it's shameful. It's still not cool to like the Eagles.
See, that's the
even
thing.
Though most of us do.
Okay, that was, I guess, what I was going for. Is like, is it cool to like the Eagles?
No, because it wasn't. It probably only just this last year. At some point, I made the mistake of telling someone I really liked the Eagles, and I got sneered at and beaten down. So
did you kick him in the junk?
I was just like, well, I don't like the Eagles. Shut up.
Just suck one.
Shut up. I like them.
You know what I just heard the other day?
What do you say to that?
I hadn't heard it for been quite a while. I mean, not years, but I mean, I hadn't really, it came up on Shuffle or something. It was like in just some compilation. I was actually cleaning out this huge pile of CDs at my home because it's like CDs. And I thought, well, what is on these? And I'm in this process of digitally archiving just all my crap, all my movies, all my records, all my everything. So then I can just lead a more Spartan existence. But I was going through and I had all of these old MP3 mix CDs, from a few years back. But anyway, so I was just putting one of them on and just letting it play in the background while I sorted through the others. And the song Wasted Time by the Eagles came on. And it's like the most, it's just the greatest song.
That song kills me.
It's so great. It's just, it's so freaking great. And I actually stopped and I just sort of sat down and just listened to it. And it's just, I mean, it is just one of the most beautiful things. Or, you know, even a more mainstream song, it's something that gets played more, it would just Take It to the Limit. How great is Take It to the Limit? I mean, I'm telling you right now, I don't care. As cool as you might think you are, or as like as hip as and above it all as you may be during the day, you put that on like after a couple of belts of booze at like 1:40 in the morning, and it's like suddenly you are Sinatra staring into the streetlight, walking the lonely road of love on which no other human travels.
Or you put that on the jukebox in a bar late at night, and first of all, people go, oh, Eagles. And then by the middle of the song, everyone's going, Take It to the Limit. Hey, you know, just waving their beers back and forth.
It really is truly great. And I don't remember how we got onto this. Ba-ba-ba-ba, Cheap Trick. Here's the thing about Cheap Trick is that, A, they're always touring. They never quit touring. And it's like they'll tour anywhere that the guy has money. It doesn't really matter. I saw an interview with Rick Nielsen, and they were saying, like, well, you play at the stadium somewhere, you know, opening for whoever, because they open for a lot of bands now. And Cheap Trick is that thing where it's like they're not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and there are more successful bands, and there are probably more well-known bands. But, you know, it's like everybody likes them. Everybody on earth loves Cheap Trick. And so you get a lot of huge acts that will ask them to come open, like now.
They've been up and down and up and down, though. It's been really interesting to see that, like, you know, they were huge, and then the stars started falling. And then I think the nadir was
The flame.
About in the early 90s, they were, like, here in Portland playing, like, you know, Bite of Beaverton or something like that. But now it's like they've been – then all of a sudden it was like everyone started rediscovering Cheap Trick again. And once again, they started heading up and playing bigger and bigger and bigger places.
And that 70s show helped them a lot, too, because they do the theme to that 70s show. And that is how a lot of people were like, hey, who's that great band that does the theme to that 70s show? And I think they also do the theme to the Colbert Report.
That's Shadowy Men from – you're right.
I think they play the opening theme.
Yeah, they might.
I could be wrong about that.
I was thinking of The Daily Show, and that was Shadowy Men from a Shadowy Planet.
Yeah, I think they do the Colbert Report theme because they appeared at one point and Colbert played it with them. But a lot of people rediscovered them through the 70s, that 70s show. But I saw somebody interview Rick Nielsen, and they said, well, you were just like opening for so-and-so, and you were playing in front of 15,000 people, and like now you're like – you know, Spirit Mountain Casino. And he was just like, he's like, hey, if there's people who want to hear my songs and there's a guy to pay me play them, I'm there. He's like, it doesn't even matter. He's like, I don't care. And he was told, that is a guy who's so completely zen with the fact that he has had a great life and continues to have a great life. And I got to tell you, I've seen Cheap Trick 7 or 8 times, most recently about a year and a half ago, and they are still fantastic. Mm. It will not impugn your memory or your love of Cheap Trick. Because I got to tell you, the only misstep, and it's only happened once, the only misstep was at one point Xander took off he had like this glittery like Jonas Nightingale jacket, and he took it off and he had like a see-through shirt, and that was bad. But that's not even because he's old, it's because he's like a spindly ass white man, and it's like he shouldn't be. If you're not Isaac Hayes, you can't really do that. But they are still so good. And you know what, and the same freaking lineup. And Bunny Carlos is like 1,000 years old.
I was about to say, if there's any way we could parlay us having a show into me meeting Bunny Carlos at some point, then I'll be able to check off yet another thing on my master list.
I think I can make that happen. If Cheap Trick came back to town, Rick Emerson is pretty sure he could hook you up with Bunny Carlos.
I mean, Rick Nielsen is cool and all, and I love watching him play guitar, but I would love to meet Bunny Carlos.
You know the thing about Bunny Carlos and Cheap Trick? This has been the weirdest show today because we're just sitting here. This is one of those shows where we are just sort of, we're just talking about whatever and forgetting that presumably it's got to be amusing. But so, like, here's hoping. But, you know, the thing about Bunny Carlos is the people forget that he is not just the band's drummer, but he is also the official historian and archivist of Cheap Trick. Bunny Carlos in his basement has a digital copy. He spent a lot of time getting that stuff digitally archived of every show they have ever played.
Holy crap.
He also has a copy of every set list from every show they have ever played.
Wow.
He is also the one, by the way, Bunny Carlos, you see Cheap Trick? Bunny Carlos is the one who makes up the set list for the show. He actually is the guy who says, here's what we're playing tonight, and here's the order in which we're playing it. And it's like, it's not the guy who sings. It's not the guy who writes the songs. It's not Tom Peterson lurking over there in the shadows. Bunny Carlos is the guy who says, like, here's tonight's set list. So how weird is that? Also, he looks like Wilford Brimley or your dad. Finally, my last thing about this.
I got one question when you get to the end of this, though.
Did you hear a couple years ago, did you ever listen to a band called Tinted Windows?
Mm-mm.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. So you got to at some point listen to Tinted Windows. They're a fantastic supergroup. Tinted Windows consists of, on bass, Adam Schlesinger, who is the lead songwriter for Fountains of Wayne, of Stacey's Mom fame, mm-hmm. And of That Thing You Do fame. He's bass player. The guitarist is James Ehoff from Smashing Pumpkins. On drums, Bonnie Carlos. And the lead singer is, what's his name? The pretty handsome brother, the middle one.
Oh, yeah.
Taylor Hanson.
Yeah, whatever.
Who actually turned into a really great singer. And I got to tell you,
I have nothing but respect for the Hanson brothers.
I love the Hanson brothers. Not the Hanson brothers, the punk group who dress like hockey players. It's just Hanson. Yeah. So they formed this band, the four of them, called Tinted Windows. And it is like a distillation of the very best Cheap Trick songs you've ever heard in your life, like as played by Fountains of Wayne. I mean, it's just,
wow.
It's fantastic. It's really good.
An asterisk in it. Okay, here's my question. The whole cool, kitsch, or reviled. How am I supposed to feel about Thin Lizzy? No one's ever really told me.
They're cool and they've always been cool.
Okay, because I love Thin Lizzy.
They've never not been cool.
They've always been cool. They still remain cool.
Well, they weren't ever big enough to be reviled. Not in this country.
Okay.
I mean, in Thin Lizzy, you know, in America, it's pretty much just Jailbreak and Boys Are Back in Town. I mean, it's the rest of the world, they're huge. In America, I don't think they've ever been... I think they're like Blur. Like, they've never been big enough here to ever be disliked.
Because I had never really talked to anybody about my Thin Lizzy fixation, which came from when I belonged to the Columbia Record Club and accidentally got one of their albums because I failed to send the postcard back and then played it one day after been sitting around for a month and went, oh, my God, this is awesome.
Yeah.
I think it was a thing for Conan O'Brien's show several years ago. Andy Richter went to I think it was like a before party or something for like the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame or something like that. But there were all of these like, you know, A-list rock people there. And he had a camera crew and he had the microphone and he was going around and he was basically asking everyone how they felt about Thin Lizzy. And every time he did it, like Melissa Etheridge or, Flea or any of these guys, and was just, oh, Thin Lizzy! And they would just rhapsodize about how awesome Thin Lizzy was. And I think Andy Richter originally thought that what he was asking something that would be funny and campy.
Yeah.
That was zany.
How do you know about Billy Squire?
But instead what he got was nothing but just like, you know, enthusiastic love for
Thin Lizzy. Is awesome.
And usually people air guitaring the riff from Boys Are Back in Town.
You know who will go on at length about Thin Lizzy is Henry Rollins. I saw him one time do spoken word and he was talking about how Thin Lizzy wrote a song. Like, Phil Lynott wrote a song for every situation in Rollins' life. And it was like, no matter what day it was, you know, no matter what he was facing, no matter if it was a good day, a bad day, or somewhere in between, he's like, Thin Lizzy has written a song for me and for my particular mood. And he said that one of the great moments in his life ever is when he went to... I guess it was in Dublin where Lynott's from. And he said he went and he saw Phil Lynott's Boyhood Home or whatever. And he thought that was one of the best moments of his life, was going to see where Thin Lizzy was created. So no. Okay. I think everybody is into those guys. You know where they got their name?
Mm-mm.
So Thin Lizzy.
Well, I know the Tin Lizzy was a car.
And when they heard the phrase Tin Lizzy, which was the Model T, Lynott being Irish, thought that they were actually saying Thin Lizzy.
Mm.
He thought that somebody was like, have you seen that thing, the Tin Lizzy? And he's like, and he thought he was hearing an accented Thin Lizzy, which is where that comes from.
Interesting.
Now you know, Dawn.
Now I know.
Knowing.
It's half the battle.
Half the battle. All right. Well, we should get to the news. We can do the Hick Watch and the so forth. Here is Dawn Taylor with the news.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
Well, let's do what may or may not be our last Joy of Christmas story.
All right. There's your Joy of Christmas. And we pretty much, I've always said that, like, through the first of the year.
Okay.
Like, up until New Year's Day. Because, like, you know... Because people are still crazy because they're still in that. It's like they're in the mid-holiday flux right now between. Because this is that week where everybody's just phoning it in.
Yeah.
Like people are showing up to work. Nobody's actually working. You know, like I've started to get those. Let me ask you this just real quickly, just before we do the Joy of Christmas.
Okay.
You and I both love Christmas, but do the holidays. Are they also frustrating for you because do they screw with your sense of routine?
Oh, yeah.
Because people aren't in the office and no one's, you know, the people, the things are closed and the hours aren't the same for stores.
And... Well, and you can't count on traffic being
right.
normal. You know, it's because, you know, I come here to work pretty much the same time every day and I leave in roughly the same time period. And yeah, during the whole week before Christmas, everything's just all off. I was not supposed to hit rush hour traffic at like, you know, 10:45 in the morning.
Right.
You know, coming in from Tualatin. And yet I do, you know, so. Things like that just tend to mess me up.
See, and so I've started to get the, you know, I've started to get the thing where I'll email people and I'll get the, I am out of the office until Monday, January 3rd, which just fills me with rage because email especially has led to this situation where we now no longer expect anyone to not answer us within like 5 seconds. You know that if you, like I found that this, there was a text message that I found this morning that somebody sent me a text yesterday and I actually have yet to respond to it because I got it yesterday and I went, well, I got to get to that at some point. And then I forgot about it. And now I've realized that it just looks like I've ignored him for like a month because it's taken a day.
I'm always shocked when I get those, and I don't get them very often, but I'm shocked when I get those sort of the equivalent of an answering machine from someone's email because my initial response is, what do you mean you're not in the office?
Right.
You don't have to be in the office to get your email. And I realize there are people who only deal with business, you know, at work.
Right.
They're not like you and I who just spend like our entire waking life, you know, sitting with a laptop or our phone and answering emails and checking our messages.
And then I do that smug thing because I work real late at night. And so it's like I'll be up at 2:30 in the morning and I'm sending off emails and I will send somebody like, so what do you think if we do this? Send. And then it's like later on I'll notice that they haven't responded back because, you know, it's 2:45 in the morning. But then I get that smug, angry superiority of like, it is only I am awake and working at this. Only I care about productivity and having a fruitful life.
See, and I'm on the other end of that sometimes where I like look, I've got a message on my phone. Oh, it was from Rick. He was asking me a question at 3 a.m.
Yeah.
Well, no, I haven't answered him yet.
Yeah. All right. Here's your joy of Christmas for December 28th.
We wish you
here is Don Taylor.
West Hartford, Connecticut police arrested a teen who they said threw a Christmas tree at her parents during an argument. Police said they were sent to a home on Boulanger Avenue. They can't possibly pronounce. I bet they don't pronounce that the way it's supposed to. It's Boulanger, but I bet they don't pronounce it in the French. They probably say Blanger.
They pronounce it
Blanger. At around 12:30 a.m. on Friday, when police arrived, they said they found the Christmas tree on its side with ornaments and decorations strewn around the room. After an investigation, police said Francesca Terrio, 19, was drunk and had attacked her mother and father, eventually throwing the Christmas tree at her father.
Well done.
Both victims suffered minor injuries. Terrio also took the phone that her mother was using to call 911 and threw it at her father. Terrio was arrested and charged with two counts of assault, disorderly conduct, interfering with a 911 call, and criminal mischief.
And the mugshot really is the reason for this story. I mean, it's amusing enough, you know, that she attacked the parents with the Christmas tree.
I love her hair.
I think I just captioned it with the thing I just said, like, bad girl, bad hair, because I couldn't come up with anything more interesting last night. But it really is awesome. If you go to rickemerson.com and you click on photos there, or you can just type it in directly, rickemerson.com/pictures, you're going to see the photo gallery. You'll go to visual aids for December 28th. And I'm telling you, the hair on this girl, I mean, it's like, and it goes beyond like Jersey Bridge and Tunnel. I mean, there's just something. There's something otherworldly about this. She almost looks, it's almost like she's doing some weird Amy Winehouse thing where she's trying to be, where she's doing some like weird, like a Motown throwback, you know, look. Like it's like 1963. Or I also had accepted the possibility that maybe the photo had been stretched somehow because her face is no picnic either.
Well, it looks like it's been squished a little bit. The photo's been squished.
But that doesn't change
the fact her hair has the curly thing and then the straight thing and then the bigness.
That's the other thing. It's not just that the hair is huge. It's that the hair is huge, but then there's like, it's like indifferent.
It looks like she may have tried to brush the beginning of it.
Right. It's like part of it's curly, but then there's like this straight part like above her forehead.
Yeah.
And I was trying to figure out like is part of it fake? Like is part of it like a weave or something? So.
And if you go to the visual aids, you can also see the picture of Gator.
Gator.
Who likes to call 911.
Hey, here's a realization I had the other day. When we were at the airport in Provo, we were renting our car, and there was a lovely one of my Nubian sisters behind the counter who was renting the car to us, and she had the weave going on. And I was thinking about this is an odd sort of thing that if you I mean that if you're a white person, you're a white woman, you're going to get the weave going on. You pretty much can only, if you're going to like be just putting basically like yarn into your hair, you can only do it if it's a totally unnatural color. That's the only way it works. And the proof of that is that like later on that day we went to Hot Topic and they did sell what was effectively like like weave material, you know, for like punk chicks, and it was all like pink and blue and bright green. Like if you were just to see somebody that had like natural hair colored like yarn or something threaded through their hair, and it's a white person, you just think that they were weird looking. If that's another thing, like only the black chicks can really make that work, and it looks fantastic. White chick does that, looks weird, looks all kinds of strange.
Yeah. There are a lot of you'll see a lot of actresses who have extensions to give themselves like bigger hair,
right?
Bigger, longer hair, you know, in movies and on television, and I think it actually kind of works on camera. But it's another one of those things like the overly plucked eyebrows that you see somebody like that in actual real life, and just the way the light hits their hair, you can tell which the fake parts are.
See,
and
but
which
I'm not
aren't.
Just talking about extensions, because I think a weave and extension is not the same thing. Like I don't think like extensions are sometimes that's like synthetic hair or it's actually real hair.
Yeah.
Whereas the weave, I think, is actually just like.
Is it? I thought a weave was essentially the same thing as extensions.
No, see, I don't know. See, it's somewhere between. This is really, you and I are the least qualified people
entire
world.
We should not even be talking about this at all.
I'm just saying,
I
don't think the deal about it, I don't think that it is meant to fool people into thinking it's real hair.
Oh, I see what you mean.
You know what I'm saying? Like, it is a stylistic choice. The extensions are there to make it look like you got more hair than you do. The weave, I think, is there to just augment the look. I don't think anybody's supposed to look at it and go, that's your natural hair in impossibly tiny, tight ringlets.
I see what you mean.
And so it is a strangeness there that, like, that the only way that, like, white girls can get away with that is if it is some fundamentally unnatural color that, like, nature would never, ever give you.
Yeah.
That is a thing where Whitey is limited in his choices.
Yeah.
All right.
Or if you have dreadlocks. You're one of those, like, blonde girls with dreadlocks, and then you, like, weave, like, yarn bits and ribbons in your dreads.
Here's the thing that white people need to never know again, and that's cornrows.
That
needs to never... ever, ever happen again.
No, that
ever.
Looks terrible.
Don't do that. Oh, wait. Okay, no. Here, we've been corrected. It says, weave / extension are synonymous. They are both intended to be seamless and go unnoticed.
Hmm.
So maybe that just means that. So maybe they maybe they occur a lot more frequently than I think. It's just that I only notice the ones that are sort of obvious. See, and the thing about it is, though, I didn't think it looked bad in any way because I figured that it was supposed to be noticeable, and I thought it was just yet another element of style that was denied to me because I'm pasty and lame. So, well, all right. Did we wrap up? Yes, we did, because the hair and the whatnot.
Yeah. So
Joy of Christmas.
That was Joy of Christmas. If you want to, I don't know, you would do the outro for the Joy of Christmas.
And.
We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Our friend Keelan follows up. If people notice, that means you got a bad weave and your hairstylist needs to be smacked. All right.
Thank you, Keelan.
Well, I'll take it under advisement. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It's 503-5—the hell? I've just forgotten the number. 505-69-64. We've also got your email. We got text. We got all that stuff coming in. Don't forget to join us tomorrow when our guests will include, I believe, Mr. Aaron Mesh from Willamette, although I could be wrong about that. Friday, Big Jim Willig will be here doing his year-end installment of Humory Comedy 101. This Friday, he will be doing Mr. George Carlin, his life, legacy, and work.
And we'll probably have brownies with edges on every
damn
piece.
Straight. We should totally do that.
I will make brownies and make sure that we have them on Friday.
See, it's not like I'm opposed to making them. It's just that I know that Lara's much better at that sort of thing than I am. That is the thing where when we met, neither of us cooked. And now she sort of does, but it's because she legitimately enjoys it. So I have no – that's a thing where it's like sometimes I will make a reference to her like, you know, her cooking or gardening or whatever. And it's not like I view that as woman's work. It's just that I can't do it and she likes doing
it. Okay, well, you remember to bring milk.
I will bring milk. I had to just start keeping some milk here. And you know, here's the other thing I need here is ice. It ruins
yes.
My whole morning ritual is screwed if I come in here and I have the Visa without ice. Then it just throws me off.
I enjoy my beverages with ice, and I drink the sodas out of the cans and the Visa out of the can, and I'm okay with it. But all the time, for months now, I've been thinking, I should just get a big bag of ice and put it in the freezer, and I just never have done it.
Life is hard.
We need ice.
Somebody's asking if we have a brownie preference. Frosting, walnuts, chopped peanuts, plain, etc.
I do not like frosting on my brownies, and I also do not necessarily need – I don't hate nuts in my brownies, but I don't need them.
It just sounds crude. I don't even know what it would mean.
But if I have a specific brownie preference, I will say that I do love the cream cheese brownie.
Yeah. Is that like a marbled sort of a thing?
Yes, the marbled cream cheese brownie. All right. So maybe I'll make those because I love those. By
the way, apparently – I get the straight ahead. Straight ahead chocolate brownie, straight no chaser. There's nothing.
Okay.
I am apparently getting a gift certificate for a weave for my birthday.
Awesome.
So there you go.
Oh, I'm looking forward to that.
Me and Kenny Powers. All right. We have a Hick Watch, do we not?
We do have a Hick Watch.
All right. Here is
lots
your,
of things.
Here's your Hick Watch for Tuesday right here on the Rick Emerson radio program.
Copenhagen makes me feel so good. Well, I put a little chew in my mouth, go spitting, slobbering all around the house. That Copenhagen makes me feel so good. Oh, yeah.
Here is Don Taylor with your Hick Watch.
I wonder how the people of the fine Copenhagen company feel about that.
You know, here's the reason that that's the theme is because that has been the theme for the Hick Watch for years and years and years. Because we couldn't come up with anything. We couldn't really come up with anything better. And Matt Peterson, who was our producer at the time, who was himself just a huge Hick, hit upon that. And it really seemed to work. And it's Toby Keith and Alan Jackson, I think. Hmm. So it had like the dual country thing going on as well. But, you know, if you run a tobacco company, it's got to be a little strange that most of your customers, especially if it's chewing tobacco, are just perceived to be rubes and idiots, you know? And I'm not saying that's always the case, but I'm just saying that there is that perception. All right. Here's Don Taylor.
A New Hampshire teenager was tasered by police on Christmas Day after fighting with his girlfriend at a mobile home park. Seth T. Dubois, who turns 18 today, was arrested Christmas morning on charges of criminal mischief.
We get a lot of names that don't match the locales today.
During his arrest, police used a taser to subdue Dubois after he attempted to put Officer William Goulet in a headlock after the police responded to the report of a domestic disturbance at the Scandia Mobile Home Park. Dubois is alleged to have damaged his 19-year-old girlfriend's 1997 Nissan Maxima after the pair fought at the mobile home he shares with his mother. Dubois is then alleged to have been en route to the home of the girlfriend's father and said he was going to, quote, burn it down. Dubois reportedly told police he had argued with his girlfriend, overreacted, had slashed a car tire, and thrown a vacuum cleaner through the windshield.
That's almost impressive.
When met by police, he insisted on seeing his girlfriend and his child.
Uh-huh.
And was advised by Officer Goulet that he was not wanted at the residence. When Dubois persisted and attempted to walk into the mobile home, he was placed under arrest and allegedly struggled with officers.
Dubois and Goulet.
I know.
It's like some horrible version of, it's like some masterpiece dinner theater.
He became combative, was told he was under arrest, and he struck one of the officers and attempted to flee. That was when the officer tased him. However, he broke free from the taser. He was stunned briefly as a result of poor contact and was able to pull the prong and wires out. And then a foot chase ensued when Officer Goulet caught up to Dubois and told him he would be tased again. Dubois dropped to his knees and was taken into custody.
So were they just, I wonder if they were just like running through the trailer park, like sort of Benny Hill style. And like he was popping out of a trash can and then he was like in a bag of leaves. And then he was looking underneath the trailer.
I believe so. Yeah. So he pulls the thing out, the taser, and then just and just takes off again. And then Officer Goulet says, I will tase you again.
Living
and then
in
he stops.
A trailer park and being named Dubois. It's like living there and like, it's like being in a homeless shelter and your last name is like Paddington the Second. Okay. There's your, there's your Hick Watch for,
Copenhagen makes me feel so good. Copenhagen.
Goddamn people are dumb.
Well, I put a little chew in my mouth, go spitting, slobbering.
You know, and he threw a vacuum cleaner, which...
Through the windshield of the car.
I mean, and it's like, I couldn't do that, so I mean, it's, I guess, well done on that front.
Well, anger gives a man super strength.
I got three things to say. One is that if you're ever throwing a vacuum cleaner, I would say that you are. That's a thing where you're a hick. There's just no getting around that.
Yeah.
Throwing a vacuum means that you're trash.
Yeah.
Secondly, you know, depending on what kind it was, it probably wasn't a Kirby, because that's probably beyond their price range. Because, you know, a Kirby, that's a heavy vacuum. That's a thing you can't be throwing.
Probably not one of the Dyson ones with the cyclone canister.
Or one from David Oreck. But thirdly, And this is a thing I wonder every now and again, but I forget to write it down. And I wonder this probably six or seven times a year, and it's like I never think to actually make the note to myself. So I'm going to ask you now.
Okay.
What is it with whatever happened to the Dustbuster? Why aren't those around anymore?
I don't know. I've been thinking about that a lot lately because I want one for here.
Because there's like so because like five, six, seven, eight, nine times a month probably there's a place where you could use a Dustbuster.
Well, I've got my whole like corner of shame with all the crumbs over here that you can't see, but which is over here by my chair.
Oh no, because I've got an equivalent pile over here.
And I'd like to dust bus. I think.
You know what those are great for? Crumbs in the bed.
I think there's a miniature Red Devil.
Yeah,
I don't know if they actually make the literal
but corded, though.
Dustbuster anymore.
The Red Devil is also corded,
oh,
I believe. I don't think they may have a charging one too. Mm. But it's like, but why would it ever have gone out of business? Everybody used it. Everybody loved it. Was there some sort of conspiracy by the large vacuum cleaner maker Association of America, like the people who made full blown vacuum cleaners? That they didn't like the Dustbuster eating into their profits?
You know, if you go online, there is an entire page for Black & Decker Dustbuster cordless hand vacuums. Apparently they are, I guess they're still for sale.
Could it just be this simple? Is it as obvious an answer as, I just haven't gone to the store and looked?
Maybe. Wow, they're expensive.
How much is a Dustbuster running? Wait, let me guess. Is this an actual Black & Decker cordless Dustbuster?
Yeah.
I'm guessing a Black & Decker cordless Dustbuster is $59.
They start at about $55,
yeah.
And then they go up because they also have wet and dry ones.
Yeah, those are great.
That are like $100.
The wet dry shop vac is one of the great, great inventions.
I didn't know they had a wet dry Dustbuster though. That's actually really a good idea.
Well, we probably didn't know that for the same reason because the last time either of us used a Dustbuster was like 1991.
Yeah.
So we didn't even have. I don't think we had the actual Dustbuster. I think we had like some bad knockoff product or something. But I mean, that's a fantastic device.
Well, if any listeners have a Dustbuster that they don't use and they don't want and would like to donate it to the Rick Emerson Show so we can clean up our crumbs, we would be happy to give it a home.
It's too bad that iTunes doesn't stop them or we could pool our iTunes cards. All right. It is the Rick Emerson radio program. I know we have many things still to do.
I have a couple of delightful stories that I think you would enjoy. And I don't know. Are you in a hurry to get out of here today?
No, I mean, I got stuff to do, but we also got stuff to do here. So,
I got nowhere to
be. Let's get these news stories taken care of and we'll kind of see where we are at that point. Here is Don Taylor.
At least 45 people, most of them voodoo priests, have been lynched in Haiti since the beginning of the cholera epidemic by angry mobs blaming them for the spread of the disease. People who practice voodoo have nothing to do with the cholera epidemic, said Max Beauvoir, the head of a voodoo organization in the Caribbean country.
From his trailer park.
Beauvoir said Thursday that he has appealed to the authorities to help before the situation gets worse. Some of the victims were killed with machetes. Others were burned alive by mobs that added tires and gasoline to stoked the fires.
How could the situation get worse?
I don't know. They're being killed with machetes and being burned alive. That sounds pretty bad.
And they're being killed with machetes and burned alive because of anger over a cholera outbreak.
Yeah.
There's no worse. I guess there could be a slightly greater number of people being burned alive.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess that counts, but still.
The cholera outbreak started in October. 40 of the victims were found in a southwest area of Haiti called Grand Anse, said Moisa Fritz Evans, a communications ministry official. The victims have been targeted because of misinformation that's been circulating in the community that voodoo practitioners were spreading cholera by using witchcraft, according to communications minister Marie Lawrence Lesegue. It was necessary to increase awareness of the disease and educate the population countrywide instead of getting into a religious war that has no ending, she said.
You think?
The killings add to ongoing woes that have hit the island after the devastating earthquake in January. About 220,000 people were killed in the earthquake and countless others left homeless. The cholera outbreak after the earthquake has killed more than 2,000 people.
Okay, so there you go.
And then 45 people have been lynched because they're voodoo priests and people think they're causing cholera.
You know, I wonder if you wake up in Haiti every day and if you just like look out the window and just go, Christ, you know, it's just that there's no good days there. I mean,
no.
I get the feeling that there is, it's all very relative, that there was just, I had a friend
of mine. There must be joy somewhere in Haiti, but it seems like it must be very hard won.
I mean, maybe. I mean, it's like you're talking about the worst, I mean, it's the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. And then occasionally, they have, not just cholera, but that was where the earthquake was, right?
Yeah.
And they had a huge earthquake there. And it's not like there was, the other thing is, I saw this guy, and it's one of those stories that one of those stories that comes out that you can sense this moment where everybody in the media looks at each other and they go, all right, are we going to report this or not? And then they all kind of, there's this moment of assent of like, agree. It's just this unspoken understanding that they're not going to report something that has just been discovered, or they're not going to rebroadcast information that has just been brought to the fore. And a guy actually wrote this whole piece. It might have been for I think it was for Time magazine. It was one of those that doesn't exist anymore. Didn't either Time or Newsweek just go away? Well, whatever. But I think it was for Time. And a guy actually wrote this whole article about Haiti, and he was just pointing out that, like, the cost to get Haiti back to, like, even where they were before, he's like, it would be cheaper to bulldoze the entire country, to, like, literally to put everybody on a boat, flatten the entire country, and start from scratch with a new city. It's like, it would be cheaper to do all of that. And he had this whole, like, price breakout of how much it would cost to take every Haitian, stick them on a boat for, like, 90 days, and then just level the entire country, and then just start again with, like, the bare minimum of, like, housing infrastructure. And he's like, it would still be better than what they have, like, what they had right before the earthquake. And it would be cheaper. And he said, like, I look like a dick saying this, but I mean, everybody would win here. We would spend less money. They would have a better home. You wouldn't have, you know, like, cholera outbreaks because they'd have, like, an actual sewage system. And it was like I saw that reported once in one place, and then it was never repeated anywhere ever again. It was just one of those things that was just – you just couldn't say out loud somehow.
I love people who figure things out like that, though, because something – I think it was about a year or so ago, or this guy who had broken everything down about the cost of living in an assisted living facility as an adult who needs care. And if you're an elderly person and you need to live in an assisted living facility where there's, you know, and they're incredibly expensive, for the same amount of money, you could just buy tickets and spend the rest of your life on cruise ships.
Yeah.
You could just live on a cruise ship.
That's fascinating. See, and you're right. I mean, I love guys. That's what makes those Freakonomics books so great, because the Freakonomics guys are always just sort of taking things apart and figuring out one of the Freakonomics books, they The reason that first book it got such prominence is because they came to the conclusion they analyzed just mountains and mountains and mountains of statistical and census data for just decade after decade, and they discovered that the crime drop in the early 90s was because of Roe v. Wade, and that the women who were most likely to give birth to criminal children were also the most likely to take advantage of legal abortion. And so they had effectively just killed the next generation of criminals before they could commit crimes. But people who are able to sort of step back and see things in a slightly different way or through a different prism, I mean, those are the guys that we really need to fund, to just sit in a room somewhere and just think of things like that. And then occasionally just wave, like, you know, like ring a bell when they've got some exciting new conclusion, like the cruise ship nursing home thing, and just tell us all. I mean, I feel like that piece of knowledge that I could just spend the rest of my money, buying cruise ship tickets and live there instead of being in a place where a guy is just, like, you know, giving me a catheter, you know, like every hour. I feel like I am so much better served by that information than by any amount of literature or leaflets coming to my home telling me about, like, Shady Palms Retirement Resort.
I mean, honestly, you know, and essentially you're getting the same thing. You're living in a place where someone is going to come and, like, you know, clean your sheets for you. Somebody else is making your food so you don't have to, like, you know, cook your own food. And you're in a place that's safe. You know, and you can get medical care if something horrible happens to you.
Right.
You're getting the same thing, except in one of them, you're, like, on a cruise. You can lay on a lounge chair and enjoy fruity beverages. And in the other one, everything smells like sweat and antiseptic, and you're surrounded by old people.
Somebody ought to invest in an island, you know, like one of those, like, guys who owns... Who is it that owns his own island in Fiji?
Branson owns an island.
Branson does. Tony Robbins does. I think Leonardo DiCaprio does, too.
Johnny Depp owns an island.
Somebody ought to buy an island, and they ought to turn it into, like, an end-of-life resort for old people. People who, you know, old people who have money, maybe they're not fantastically wealthy, but they're wealthy enough that they could afford a really nice retirement home. And instead, it's just like booze and whores and just, you know, and it's like, it would just be like that donkey island in Pinocchio or whatever.
Well, I have a group of female friends that we've known each other for, God, about 20 years at this point, and we have talked for a long time about, you know, spending our golden years just pooling our resources and living somewhere and having, like, a cabana boy wait on us.
Yeah.
That's pretty much it, you know, because that way we know we're all together and we're all taken care of. And again, we'll be more financially secure if we all pool our money, and we'll just hire a guy to wait on us.
This was okay. Now this was the reason why Golden Girls was such a huge hit, because I think that is how many people envision the end of their, especially people of a certain. I don't even want to say because they always said that it was like a gay fantasy that's how gay men envision themselves at the end of their life. You know, like growing old with their best pals and you know whatever and being single and swinging and whatever. But I don't even think it's that. I think it is that probably plus any number of people who probably – people who don't have kids and people who maybe have either a small family or no family or are estranged from their family. And so it's like that's what you picture, right? You just picture some great place and it's like you and your pals, you know, at 70 years of age. And so you're basically – it's like the Sunshine Boys meets Cocoon, you know, or something. And you're just – yeah. And sort of, so somebody ought to start that island.
Although my husband's friend Mark made an interesting point, though, that it's going to be really, really interesting to see this generation of people be elderly, because you're going to have, you know, you go to like the senior center now and there's like bingo and the various games they play. It's going to be a bunch of like 75-year-old guys sitting around playing Dungeons and Dragons.
Totally.
And that's going to be odd.
That would be fantastic. I mean, it's, you know, that is the sort of thing that I am glad that I am. I mean, I'm not a spring chicken, but it's, you know, I'm glad that I'm young enough that I will get to see that. There are certain things that I am glad.
And quoting movies to each other.
Yeah, I am. You know, exactly. I mean, there's just, you know, that's a big Twinkie. You know, and then just waiting for a sitz bath or something. I am glad that I am young enough that I will get to see, you know, several more evolutions of the human cycle. You know, society wise. All right. Well, here's the question: Do we want to do a top five?
Sure. I like a top five. I like a good top five.
So I'll tell you what. What we'll do is this. I'm going to we'll take just the smallest break. It's not even really a break. It's just because I want. There's something I want you to hear.
All right.
So I'm going to play a short little thing. And probably get myself a glass of liquid refreshment. Mm. And then we'll come back with the top five. The top five perfectly crafted pop songs that are not Surrender by Cheap Trick. but that then, which was interesting because it was actually a little bit of a challenge to put it together. It was because, you know, he actually asked me. He said, like, and he seemed to think that I had a spreadsheet or something that I, you know, that I had actually sat down mathematically and figured out why Cheap Trick was the greatest pop song, you know, ever created. And I suppose I could probably, you know, why Surrender was. And I probably created a, you know, a list of such reasons, you know, if I had to. I am not a guy like Rivers Cuomo, who literally does carry like a three-ring binder around where he charts like the aspects of various pop songs. He had this whole thing. Rivers Cuomo, I don't know if he still does, but for many years, he would carry this binder around. And whenever he heard a great pop song, he would sit and he would write out on a spreadsheet the various aspects of the song, from the production to the melodic style, to what kind of chords it used, to the key change, to the bridge, to the instrumentation. And then he said that what he would do is, like, once a year he would feed all of that into a computer because he was trying to write the greatest pop song in the history of the world. And so he would just feed all of these variables over the course of a year into this program that would tell him the most frequently occurring elements in great pop songs. And he was thinking that then he would have, you know, the mathematical ability to write the greatest song ever. So I don't do that, but it was interesting to sort of sit and think about what makes one song better than another, and really, what do I quantify as a great pop or pop rock song? So we'll get to that. Let's see. Tomorrow, Mr. Aaron Mesh, I believe, from Willamette Week will be here. Friday, Big Jim Willig will be here with another installment of Humor Me, Comedy 101. He'll be doing his end-year installment. That is Mr. George Carlin. I will take just the smallest break here because I wanted to play this. This is that group Tinted Windows that I mentioned to you.
Oh.
So this is James E. Hoff from Smashing Pumpkins, Adam Schlesinger from Fountains of Wayne, Bun E. Carlos from Cheap Trick, and Taylor Hanson. This group called Tinted Windows. This is they only ever put out the one record, and it doesn't seem like they're probably going to put out another one anytime soon. But this was the second single off their self-titled debut, which is just it is just called Tinted Windows. And I do strongly recommend picking it up. It's a fine record. This is called Messing With My Head. So we'll be back after this. You are listening to the Rick Emerson radio program.
Come on, come on. You've been messing with my head for oh so long now.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. It's 503-505-6964. Coming up tomorrow, Mr. Aaron Mesh from Willamette Week. Straight ahead, we have your top five for today. So it's the top five perfectly crafted rock or rock pop songs that are not Surrender by Cheap Trick. So that was Tinted Windows, which is... And if you know, and I will just say this. Usually, I say if you like that song, you'll love their album. I'll put it the other way. If you don't like that song, you're not gonna like anything else they do because it's all effectively just that. It was because I'm a huge fan of Fountains of Wayne, but Fountains of Wayne also have that thing where it's like when you hear that, it's like that song, like that Stacey's Mom song. And I know a lot of people who bought the record, and there's some really, really great singles on that Fountains of Wayne record. There's a song called Mexican Wine, which is great, and there's a song called Hey Julie, which is fantastic. But somebody said to me, he's like, well, you know, the bands obviously know... They know, like, what the best song on the record is, or the record company always knows what the catchiest song on the record is because that's what they release as a single. You know, there's an A&R guy who goes, well, that's your single right there. That's far and away the best thing on the album. And the guy said, well, why doesn't anybody ever just say, well, like, write a whole album that sounds like that? And so that really is... The Tinted Windows record is great because I think Adam Schlesinger finally just got sick of the other guys in the band, like, watering down his compositions. So he just decided to write an entire album that sounded like that Stacey's Mom song. Because Stacey's Mom itself sounds a lot like Cheap Trick. So I strongly recommend picking that, but it is just called Tinted Windows. As Kurt Loder would say, do try to catch it. Let's do, like, one or two here, and then we'll do the top five, and okay. then we'll leave. Leave this place.
All right. The so-called Patriot pilot who blasted airport security in a YouTube video has revealed his identity as Chris Liu, an American Airlines pilot. Liu's attorney, Don Werno, responds to criticism that posting the video endangers airport security.
This is
TSA.
TSA.
I think it's disingenuous to suggest that we're showing anything that the public doesn't already know. We can all go into a terminal with a video camera and take that same footage, and if we're taxiing on an aircraft, for example, we can take more footage on the other side.
So what is it that I'm still unclear about what it is exactly that he revealed.
He showed some airport employees going through a door without having to...
Oh, without being scanned or checked or whatever.
Stuff, yeah. Liu explains why he did it.
Let's see. This is TSA 2. I'm sorry.
I think it's disingenuous to suggest that...
Fail.
Anyway.
Don't, for the love of...
I think it's
just like everything just started to cycle in my head over and over again. I'm sorry. That's totally my fail there.
Okay.
I brought shame on everyone, Don. I'm sorry.
Well, let's read something else.
Okay.
Florida power and light customers are spending $4.7 million plus $550 an hour to heat the water of a 170-mile-long Indian River lagoon. The heated water is required by the state of Florida to provide a winter habitat for manatees, the 500-pound sea cows that are on the endangered species list. Manatees have congregated near the now-defunct FPL power plant in Port St. John, Brevard County, for more than 40 years. They come during cold weather because the plant, when active, discharged water that was 12 degrees warmer than the surrounding lagoon water. And apparently, even though the plant is now closed, the manatees still go there.
Okay, so let me understand this. So, first of all, I'm not playing the Florida Sounder because I failed on the second TSA cut.
Okay.
I don't deserve to hear the Florida Sounder.
Yeah, right.
So we have, this is just like a funhouse mirror. So we have decided to construct something to replicate an unnatural phenomenon which was impacting the creatures there before. But which is now gone, so it's returned to its natural state,
right?
Which no longer works.
Right.
Okay, just checking.
Well, the thing is, they got in the habit of going there for over 40 years because there was this—
Because it was warm water because of a factory.
Right, and they suffer hypothermia and can die if the water temperature drops below 60, and it often does that during the winter. So for 40 years, they became dependent on being near this power plant because the water is 12 degrees warmer. FPL demolished the power plant in August of this year, and state regulators said, what about the manatees? So they've required the power company to install an artificial water warming system specifically for the manatees. It will cost up to $550 an hour to operate.
Jesus.
Before the power plant began operation in the 60s, manatees migrated south for the winter. State biologists believe the species is now conditioned to stay in the cooler northern waters and would suffer a catastrophic die-off if the warm water wasn't available to them.
Okay.
So
it's almost like we just can't win. Whether we install something, whether we don't install something, if we interfere, if we don't interfere, we are just, I think we are just fundamentally effed. Let's see if I've just,
I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, out of a sense of completism, I think I found the second TSA cut that I have to play at some point. But what were you going to say?
No, there's just this whole thing that Jim Gaffigan did in his act. And I think he also did it on Dr. Katz, on one of the Dr. Katz episodes about the manatee. And it's just, you're a sea cow. I'm a manatee. Now, you're the sea cow. Oh, that's hurtful.
I think he was. I think he was actually just here, or he's coming here. I could be wrong about that. But he's not dead, is he?
No, he's not. He's still alive and working and hilarious.
All right. Well, there's a guy who's dead, I guess, who's not coming to town. Never mind. Okay. That made sense in my head. That made all kinds of sense until it was exposed to the outside air, okay. and then just as blood changes color, the humor content changed there.
Yeah. Did you want more news, or do you want to just go to that top five?
Let's just go to the top five. I've written it differently this time now because it seems like no matter how I position these on the page, it displeases you some way. So I've done this now where it's reading from the top down.
Okay. Yeah. No, that's
honorable mention at the top.
You've done that many times before, and it worked beautifully.
I just don't know what's right anymore. Here's your top five for what the hell is today? Tuesday, December 28th, 2010.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, fire.
Counting is wonderful. Counting is marvelous. Counting's the best thing to do. Counting is happiness. Counting is ecstasy. I love to count, don't you?
Hey, before we do the top five, speaking of the brownie pan, the All Edges brownie pan that our good friend Seamus sent our way, somebody wants to know, says, can you ask Don what the hell something that's clad is? I think a cookware that is clad.
Oh, that's when it's bonded, basically.
It's a different type, so it's different types of metal that are all...
Yeah, bonded together.
Sealed together.
Yeah.
Why would you, why would you want that?
I don't think I know specifically. It has something to do with the conduction of heat.
Like a more even heat or something?
Yeah, and also how some metals will bend and contract and expand and other metals won't.
So if you have multiple metals together, so is it like a thing where if the different kinds of metals are put together into like a saucepan or something, that it's stronger than just the one kind
of
metal?
Yeah. If you get like they're really good quality saucepans, for example, the ones that it'll have like a second layer like metal disc that's been welded to the bottom, so
right.
It's not just a thin layer of metal sitting directly on the heat source. There's actually a thicker metal plate that absorbs the heat and like basically radiates it evenly across the bottom of the pan.
All right. Hey, have you ever noticed how the ending of the top five theme, which is the sort of the counts theme there, mm-hmm. how it kind of sounds like some of the score from The Godfather?
I always think it sounds a little bit like scary Tim Burton circus music.
I could see that, too, because I guess it's supposed to be like a Romanian sort of a march or something. This is your top five for Tuesday, by the way. Pardon me.
I'm very pleased to see this first song that we're going to play, which we were just talking about at the break, about how much I love this song.
That is a coincidence. It was right there. So we'll talk about it here in a second. This is just in my opinion, and it's, you know, and there's sort of a wide net being tossed here because rock and pop sort of blend together really, really strangely sometimes, where you can't really tell where one starts and one begins. But under the rock pop umbrella, these are the top five most perfectly crafted songs that are not Cheap Trick Surrender. And the distinction that I've made is that if the thrust of a song is to be overtly pop, even if it has the instrumentation of a rock song, then it counts. In other words, Master of Puppets, no matter how well crafted it is, doesn't really count because it's not meant to be a pop song. So, you know, a rock song that is meant to be catchy, melodic, and bouncy, and, you know, you hear it and you go, hey, that's a great song. What is that? You know, in the way that a pop song would, that counts. So I had to limit it to, like, not be like country songs and whatever, because then it's,
and honestly, by that standard, I would have put this honorable mention way higher up on the list.
I have a reason for not doing so, but that's okay. But we'll get to here in just a second. So this is your top five. Here's your honorable mention. We've already exhausted the music,
yes.
So here's your honorable mention.
Honorable mention is The Wonders, That Thing You Do.
The only reason I made this honorable mention, pardon me, is because.
Because it was made for a movie and not manufactured as a record.
Well, and it's not even like I am opposed to, like, manufactured music as such. I mean, you know, like, I have no problem with, like, brill building, you know, constructs and with, you know, I love bubblegum music. I came very, 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 very close to putting an Ohio Express song called Chewy Chewy on here, which is one of my favorite songs of all time. And that is just where some producer and some studio hacks just sat down and, like, you know, like Rivers Cuomo with a spreadsheet and said, we're going to construct a hit. I have no problem with that. This did almost seem like cheating, though, because it's not just that it was a construct. It was deliberately constructed for a movie to fit in a certain style and a certain mode. And I guess maybe that's an arbitrary distinction. I don't know.
No,
it's
a song that was created for a movie to be
a thing.
A thing, to be a perfectly crafted pop song.
Yeah, which I guess maybe shouldn't rule it out. I mean, I guess that shouldn't disqualify it from being higher. But it seemed like it was in, it's not even that it's not as good as the others. It seemed like it was somehow in a separate category. So, but how great is this song?
I love this song.
This is
I love everything about this song. I love the drums in this song so much.
This is about as good as music gets. And it's only like, 2 minutes and 49 seconds or something. Middle eight. And so F this guy, because he's the same guy that wrote, you know, like Stacey's Mom and that song you just heard, the Tinted Windows song. So I,
The Oneaters.
I don't know I don't know if this is public or not. I interviewed a guy a couple years ago. I interviewed a writer from The Daily Show. And he was one of the guys who wrote Colbert's Christmas special, actually. Mm. And he had written a book. And anyway, I said, so what's next for you? What's on the horizon? He goes, well, Stephen Colbert and I are doing another Christmas special. And I'm just continuing to write for The Daily Show. And also, I've got this best-selling book I've just put out. Oh, and I'm writing a musical with Adam Schlesinger. This guy here. So, I mean, it's just, he's one of those guys. I mean, Schlesinger and this writer both. I mean, the guys who just have more talent coming out of their pores than, like, any 10 people.
Was that the novel about the guy who wrote the novel and then...
No, it was a parody of the What to Expect When You're Expecting.
Oh, okay.
But it was told from the fetus's point of view.
Oh, okay.
How great is that? And then you just see Chris Isaac sing, shh. Man, that was swinging. Okay, sorry.
Number five.
Such a retard.
The Riverdales, Back to You.
The Riverdales, fronted by the one and only Mr. Ben Weasel.
I don't know this song.
It's a great song. It's got so few moving parts. It's basically got two chords. And the production style never changes. It's just the same guitar sound.
It's a little Ramones sounding.
It's very Ramones sounding. He said he was tired of the Ramones not making good new records, so he was going to make them himself.
Oh, well, there you go.
But it's all, you get to the chorus here, and it does so much with so little. Can I just tell you this? And I'm, you know, Rick Emerson is all man, but let me just, you listen to a song like this and you realize something. You realize kind of how the female-male dynamic works in the world of, like, rock performer, rock fan, because there are a few things that I think that are more compelling and interesting and alluring, depending on who you are, than the snot-nosed tough guy punk singing the sweet song.
Oh, yeah. That's that whole, you know, tough guy with a baby, tough guy with a puppy thing.
Totally.
That ladies find so alluring.
So the reason this song is great to me is because, A, it's so straight ahead in that it's just, there's no, I think the solo is actually being played on the bass, by the way, so there's no actual guitar solo. There are so few chords here, they almost don't exist. There's no variation in the tone, in the guitar sound, the effect. The song doesn't change or go anywhere. There's no middle eight. And as of this point, there are not even really any more words. It's just the chorus repeated for the next 2 minutes. And it's got a whoa-oh, which I'm a sucker for. And it's legitimately simple and straightforward, but catchy and beautiful. I could listen to this song every day for the rest of my life. I mean, it's just fantastic. And Ben Weasel's another one of those guys who just, I mean, he just writes albums, like, by the bushel full, because he's in Screeching Weasel, and he writes, like, half the songs for the Queers, and he's in the Riverdales, and that band, the Methadones, that we played a couple weeks ago, he writes songs for them, too. He just sits at home and just cranks stuff out, and he has more than he can record, so he just gives them to other people. These are the top five most perfectly crafted pop/rock songs that are not Surrender by Cheap Trick, in my opinion. Don Taylor?
Number four is actually The Ramones. Sheena is a punk rocker.
And the fact that this was not a huge hit on the U.S. charts or, like, any chart anywhere does not change the fact that it is a hit song.
It got a surprising amount of radio airplay in L.A. It got a lot of radio play.
You know what I never noticed till, like, the thousandth time that I heard this is on the little pre-chorus there on the "She just couldn't stay, she had to get away." There's female backing vocals, and they're on the chorus too, but they're buried so low in the mix you can barely hear them. It's all for that moment right there. That little change in the, like, the second half of the chorus. And there's that weird, like, sleigh bell sound happening in the background. It's just, like, that's as good as it gets.
And the hand claps. I know how you love the hand claps.
I love me some hand claps. They're ready to go now. They got this. They're going to the discotheque. Go. Right here.
Yeah.
I never noticed those before. And I don't think that's Dee Dee Ramone. I think those are female vocals in the background. I mean, the fact that this was not a colossal hit is one of the great injustices of all time, you know, in the music world. I mean, it's just inconceivable to me that American listeners or American radio programmers heard this and went, "No, now we're gonna play Christopher Cross records some more." Let's play Do You Think I'm Sexy again. It's just great. I mean, it's like great doesn't even do it justice.
Yeah, this got a lot of radio play on K-Rock in L.A., K-R-O-Q. But not on, like, any of the other stations, not on, like, KLOS, or if KLOS was even in existence at that point, but the mainstream stations. And there was, this is one of the songs that, the Ramones were one of those bands that it was almost like some sort of, like a secret handshake.
Right.
That if you were someplace public, and somebody was playing K-R-O-Q, and the Ramones were on it, you started singing along, you could, like, see, like, the other person who knew the Ramones, because there'd be, like, one person out of the 30 people around
right.
who'd also be singing along, and you'd, like, look at each other like, yeah, you know the Ramones.
You know, the Ramones are another one of those acts, though, that they've gone through the four stages, because they were, even though they never really had mass popularity, you know, they were sort of the next big thing for a long time, and it didn't really ever happen, but they were the next big thing, and everybody was sort of, you know, they got a lot of ink and a lot of press, and everybody thought they were going to break through and be huge, and then they fell out of favor because... improbable as it may seem in retrospect, people started to dislike them because people kept saying, well, you know, they're making the same record over and over again. And then people disliked them because they made records that sounded different. Like they made something with Phil, they made End of the Century with Phil Spector, and they started broadening out. And then people found that to dislike about them. And then they came back as sort of camp and sort of kitsch. Like I remember when I was in Salt Lake and I would have my Ramones shirt on, and a guy would be like, oh, the Ramones, that's hilarious. And I'd say, well, what do you mean? He goes, well, you know, it's funny. And I would just say, you know, and immediately I would get all defensive about it. And he was, he was just sort of a jackass. But he would say, well, you know, it's like most, he said to me at one point, he said, well, you know, I mean, they're okay. You know, they're a novelty band, but they're okay. And I was just immediately like urged to kill rising, and I had to end the conversation. But
they were just never in the right place at the right time, because they were right there at the very beginning of punk. But the thing is, their music was really super pop.
Right.
And there was such... you know, there was such a resistance against punk by the mainstream. And so, and of course, it was like when anything new like this starts on, there was also all of the news reports about the people getting stabbed and killed at all those punk
right,
rock shows.
Right.
So it was really dangerous, and it was not to be encouraged. Then when the Sex Pistols broke through, the Sex Pistols brought this sort of really hard-edged sounding punk. And at that point, people started really embracing punk. And the Ramones were too pop.
Right. They were neither fish nor fowl, and they couldn't. And that they're doing like records with Phil Spector, and they're doing all these like records without any guitar and like with a glockenspiel, and they're doing everything they could to actually have huge hits, which was of course forbidden because you were not allowed to have like melody or any aspirations to make money or be successful in any way ever. And that they changed, and so they alienated their hardcore fan base with that. And it's, you know, but you can really make a case that they were, at least during the time they were active, that they were the most unappreciated, underrated band of all time. I mean, during the years that they were active, there was probably no more underrated band in the world than the Ramones. I mean, for what they accomplished. So it's but now, you know, of course, and it is so perfect with the Ramones. It's just like the Ramones' luck. That as soon as they're all dead, you know, everybody but Tommy, basically, suddenly the world's like, you're geniuses, you know. But it's, of course, after Johnny's got cancer and Joey cacks it, you know, and then suddenly everybody kind of wakes up and realizes, oh, my God, they were awesome this entire time. Jesus. All right. These are the top five perfectly constructed pop or rock songs that are not Cheap Trick's Surrender.
Number three, Sam Cooke, Wonderful World.
That's what I'm talking about.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology.
And again, such a simple song, but it's so perfect and great, and one of those ideas that nobody had had, you know, before him. It was, you know, where he was singing about school subjects and putting in romance in those terms.
This song was kind of spoiled for me because before I ever heard Sam Cooke's version of his own damn song, I had heard the James Taylor version like a million times and didn't really care for it very much.
It's not good. Yeah, it's not very good.
So I just never really thought it was a very good song. And then eventually one day I actually heard Sam Cooke's version and thought, oh.
Yeah.
Oh, now I get it.
I love Sam Cooke. I'm a huge fan of Sam Cooke, just as you know, the man as well as the performer. Because he was one of the first black artists he had his own production company, he had his own publishing company, produced his own records and insisted on writing his own material, owned his own masters. But I'm trying. And it's such a short song, but it's got all the elements. It's got the little bridge here.
Mm-hmm. Student, baby.
I can win your love for me.
God, what a voice, too.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology.
And it's such a legitimately sweet song.
I actually saw something about James Taylor a couple of weeks ago where they're talking about him, the beginning of his career, and here came this white boy with this, and somebody said, and a voice like Sam Cooke. And I thought,
no
he didn't.
No.
I mean, James Taylor's voice was quite good for James Taylor, but nothing like Sam Cooke at all.
No, that's... Why would anybody say that? That's ridiculous.
I don't know.
That makes no sense.
Richard,
yeah. Well, I do know that I love you.
I love those kinds of...
The backing vocals.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the great thing about that song is that, like all the great pop songs, it doesn't overstay its welcome. It's like it comes, it does the job, it leaves. That's it. Done. Out. If you want to hear it again, you got to go buy the single. These are the top five perfectly constructed pop or rock songs that are not Cheap Trick's Surrender.
Number two, The Beach Boys' Wouldn't It Be Nice? Somewhere.
No. Wait, hold on a second. No. There we go.
I have this visual in my head with this song because there's a scene in Shampoo with Warren Beatty making his way through this enormous Hollywood party through the house and through the backyard. He's trying to find Julie Christie. He's actually looking for Goldie Hawn. And this is playing during that. And so that's just burned in my head now whenever I hear this song.
And this is that moment where the backing vocals come out, and it's just like it is like pouring out a bottle of distilled sunshine. I mean, and again, the song is less than 2.5 minutes long.
I'll still sometimes just play Endless Summer and just listen to all of Endless Summer from start to finish, and it's like just overdosing on this just insane, wonderful, good feeling that you get inside that is just completely inexplicable.
It is one of the... That is one of the best compilations of all time. That is one of the best collections of music ever, the Endless Summer record. And the fact that this song manages to be so catchy when it's so unbelievably complex at times. You know, God Only Knows is the same way, and so much of their music is the same way, where it's... I mean... It's got all of these weird glissando parts and everything going on, and it's like, but at the same time, you can hum it the second time you hear it. And it's got this weird slowing down.
You know, it seems the more we talk about it, it only makes it worse to live.
Song that always just makes me feel like music is some kind of magic that is beyond my abilities. Like, how do you figure out, how do you know you can do that with voices and with notes and with instruments and just make that out of nothing?
I had a friend of mine, actually, who was a dyed-in-the-wool atheist, but he actually said at one point, we were listening to, bonded early, and we had the same love for Stevie Nicks, but we were big Fleetwood Mac fans, and but we were listening to, and I think this is before they had done their reunion. I think this is before they'd done the big Get Back Together tour, and they'd done the VH1 special. So I think they were also sort of in that they were viewed as being sort of a corny, and people hadn't come back around to realizing how great Fleetwood Mac was. But anyway, so he was one of the first people I met when I was out living on my own who loved the song Landslide. And we were talking about the song Landslide and how great it was. And he actually said something really great about that song in particular. But he said that Landslide, he said when he listened to that, he said listening to music like that song was one of the only things that ever made him consider the possibility that there was a soul of some kind. And I don't necessarily know that I agree with that, but I do get it's exactly what you said. When it's like, how can you even... It's like, I'll hear music sometimes and I'll be like, well, how the hell would you even start to write that? How would you even sit down and begin writing a song like that? Because it's so unbelievably unlike, especially if you're Brian Wilson 45 years ago when nothing like that exists. I mean, there's nothing like it. Or the goddamn Beatles, you know, where you listen to A Day in the Life and you just want to go like, you know, F you. Like, there's no, it's impossible to write that. No one can do that. It can't be done. Jesus. I know it sounds like this is making me really bitter. It's not. Yeah. I'm just saying, like, come on. I mean, it's just, you know, and especially Brian Wilson, who there's, I don't know if I've mentioned, I don't think we've talked about this, but there's this, there's several great documentaries about him, but there's the one, the I Just Wasn't Made for These Times, that Don Was did. And Linda Ronstadt, of all people, she tells the greatest story about how she was working on a, she was working on a record with Brian Wilson, and it was a record where it was like all of these, it was like these sort of very traditional like arias, but they were sort of Latin themed and like had a Spanish flavor. And it was not rock at all. It wasn't pop. It was like these weird 4- and 5-part harmony arias that she was working on, and like a very Baroque kind of music. And so she and Brian Wilson are in the studio, and they're trying to nail this 4-part harmony for this like classical music aria that she's recording. And he's trying, he's having her go through it again and again. And he's like, no, it's just not right. That's just not the harmony, you know, and he's having her try different things, and nothing is really working. And again, it's like this very, very complex, elaborate, like almost Gregorian type of music, and nothing is really working. And he goes, well, hold on a second, I got to think. And he wanders off to the corner in the studio where there's this broken down piano, and he just sits down and he just starts playing this like this insane like boogie woogie song, just dun da dun da dun da dun da, and just does it for like 2 minutes. And then he just stops and he closes the band and he goes, okay, I got it. And he comes back over, and he's figured out like the harmonies for this like Gregorian classical song that they were working on. So like while he was just sitting down playing this like blues shuffle on the piano, some other part of his brain just sat down and figured out how to do harmonies and 4-part harmonies in a different key, in a different genre, for a different song.
Yeah.
And that's why I can't write Wouldn't It Be Nice.
Well, also, and then you wonder why he's crazy.
Yes. Yeah. These are the top 5 most perfectly constructed pop or pop rock songs that are not Surrender by Cheap Trick. Don Taylor?
Number 1 is Daydream Believer.
7. What number is this, Chip?
7A.
Okay, no, I mean, don't get excited.
It's a fantastic song.
It's because I'm short, I know.
I mean, and it's really just a game of inches. I mean, I don't even know how you rank one of these songs above another, but...
Neath the wings of the bluebird as she sings.
I will just say this. There's nothing I can think of that would make this song any better. I cannot conceive of a single way to improve this song, except to have it go on for like an hour.
And I rise, wipe the sleep out of my eyes. My shaven razor's cold. And it stings. Cheer up, sleepy Gene. What can
this also was early in the Beatles' career when they're actually having all of the Beatles,
the monkeys
perform.
Right.
On, you know, they hadn't started bringing in a bunch of studio musicians to fill in for them yet. They were actually, all 4 of them are on this record.
Yeah, and they're all singing.
Yeah.
Now you know how happy I can be.
During my punk rock days, I had a friend, a guy we knew, we used to see at all the shows, who was a huge Monkees fan. Huge Monkees fan. And would bring us like bootlegs of Monkees records,
right,
when you couldn't get Monkees records. And he ended up going on to getting hired. He was hired by Rhino to put together all of their Monkees compilations.
How great is that?
So he was in heaven. He got to work with the masters and remaster all the Monkees albums.
To continue with today's theme, they are maybe the best example of the band that was loved, then reviled, then kitschy and campy, and now everybody just sort of acknowledges that, you know, that whatever one wants to say about the Monkees, they were a great and important group in their way.
And also, you know, they may not have written most of their music, but they had some of the best songwriters in the business writing the music for them. Boyce and Hart and Neil
right.
Diamond and Carole King and Jerry Goffin. This song was written by one of the Kingston Trio.
Well, and in the end, it really is just the song that matters.
Cheer up, sleepy Jean.
Boy, and they do that great thing of where they add a different type of harmony on the final chorus. So there's one type of harmony through the first 2 choruses, and then they add a second layer of harmony here at the end.
Also, if you ever get to see the video with him dancing with Tony Basil.
Yeah.
Doing his little Davy Jones dance with his bobbing head. Tony Basil, who was Davy Jones' stand-in.
I didn't know
on
that.
On the TV show and in the movie Head. Because she was, like, physically the same size as
She's
him.
She's a miniature person.
Yeah. to a date. Well, actually, no, I'm wrong about that. She did their choreography. Rodney Bingenheimer was Davy Jones'
stand-in. That's right, because I remember seeing him talk about that in that the Mayor of the Sunset Strip movie or whatever. All right, awesome. So there you go. So that's that. And I know there's like a jillion things that ought to be on there. Again, there's that Ohio Express song that I really love. I love like really, really like what everybody else would perceive as really cheesy, terrible bubblegum music, like the kind you would get off the back of a cereal box. I love that. Like the 1910
we both love the Archies
Company and all that stuff. Yeah. I mean, it's like I have no shame with any of that. I'm an unabashed fan of all of it. Well, we should probably end. Let's see. So today is a Tuesday. That means tomorrow we'll talk to Mr. Aaron Mesh. I believe it is Aaron tomorrow from Willamette Week. Friday, Mr. Big Jim Willig will be in the studio and so forth. And after a brief musical interlude, we'll have an encore of today's Legion of News program, followed by an encore of this very fine radio show. In the meantime, we will say goodbye to you for now. It is Tuesday, December 28th, 2010. So thank you for listening. Live from the plushly appointed studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the milk packing district, we come your way every day, Monday through Friday, following Legion of News, which airs noon till 1 over at Cascadia.fm. At the news desk, it's Don Taylor, Advanced Technology and Magic Weapon Minister Thomas Gill, Executive Producer Bruce Hagler, Chief of Staff Cheryl Kanakoa. As always, we'll see you again tomorrow at noon, followed by this program shortly after 1 o'clock. The Rick Emerson Show made possible by a generous grant from you. It is Tuesday, December 28th, 2010, and that is The Frequency. Kenneth, thanks for listening. Be safe. See you all tomorrow. Bye now.